We'll be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. If you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on Global Player and the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinion, put your news categories in the order that you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1 on LBC, it's Richard Spur, but right now, here's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We'll talk about the scams that are becoming so sophisticated, people are advised to take extraordinary measures to stay safe. The railways are being renationalised. We'll find out what that means for us passengers. A great supporter of the arts, Alan Yentob, has died. We'll look at the health of the creative industries in this country. There's an update on the Ukraine war, and we'll check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there and get a weather update for the summer ahead. But first, we have a declining birth rate and an ageing population, a bad combination. But why are people being put off having children? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom. It's emerged the man being detained by police investigating a house fire which killed three children and their mother is now being held under the Mental Health Act. Two other people were also injured at Stonebridge in northwest London on Saturday morning. The Metropolitan Police says the dead were 43-year-old Nusrat Usman, her children Mariam, Musa and Rais. Officials in Gaza say at least 30 people have been killed today by new Israeli strikes on the territory. It's thought they happened in Khan Yunis, Jabalia and Nusayr, and the dead include a local journalist and a senior rescue official. So far, the Israeli military has not addressed today's strikes, but Rosalia Bollin from the children's aid agency UNICEF has been telling LBC starvation is also killing many people.
Malnutrition is happening already right now. Children are dying right now of hunger. We are meeting with those children, children of 6 months old who weigh 2.5 kilos, which is the weight of like a neonate.
A police officer who remains in a critical condition after being hit by a car while on duty has been named as PC Christopher Miller. The 38-year-old was seriously injured during a collision in the Stoke Poges area of Buckinghamshire on Thursday night. Two men arrested on the suspicion of attempted murder are still being questioned. Deputy Chief Constable Ben Snuggs at Thames Valley Police says it's affected everyone on his team.
Police officers face danger every single day. PC Christopher Miller was simply doing his job, serving the public and keeping our communities safe. Sadly, Christopher has sustained extremely serious injuries, and we are doing all we can to investigate the exact circumstances.
The Conservatives in Scotland are calling for police stop and search powers to be extended there because of what they've described as a growing epidemic of youth violence. They say it's after 13 alleged knife attacks against teenagers over recent months, two of which were fatal. Holyrood says the use of stop and search powers is a matter for Police Scotland. And in sport and in football, Chelsea have qualified for the Champions League with a 1-0 win at Nottingham Forest. Aston Villa also missed out on Europe's top competition, having lost 2-0 at Manchester United, but Manchester City and Newcastle United have qualified. LBC weather, scattered showers continuing in the north and the west of the UK overnight, with brisk winds as well. Drier for the south and the east, but still a chance of a shower and a low in the far north of around 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. The Observer today reported that Keir Starmer has told the Treasury to find the £3.5 billion it would cost to abolish the child benefit cap. But as the refrain is, if you can't afford kids, don't have them. And the UK is continuing with a downward trend in the birth rate, which is currently 1.4 children per woman, not enough to replace us, then perhaps we can't afford not to have them. Let's talk about this with Dr. Paul Morland. Dr. Morland is a demographer and author of No One Left, Why the World Needs More Children. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening.
What are your thoughts on the child benefit caps? It doesn't amount to much. Is it really a factor in putting people off having children?
Well, the first thing to say, which is a political, perhaps rather than demographic point, is the government seems very confused. So we're getting signals out of Keir Starmer that it might be dropped and third and fourth and so on children would get it. Then Angela Rayner, on the other hand, is saying, no, that's not going to happen. And maybe it will be, I mean, she's leaking appears to be coming from her office, that it may be means tested. So the government's in a bit of a confusion. The second thing is it's all very much about child poverty, which is an incredibly important topic. Nobody in the government is seriously thinking about the other aspect, which is just how many children we have. The fact that we have had too few children in this country for over 50 years, the fact that the labour force is drying up, we have too much reliance in immigration, which is having huge political impacts, and the whole economy is being sapped by a lack of energy as we age. It's wonderful that people should live long, wonderful to have many people in retirement, enjoying their retirement, enjoying pensions and the healthcare, but we cannot keep that going if we don't have enough kids. And we're not putting any kind of incentives in place for people to have children.
Well, on the subject of incentives, the child benefit amounts to £26.05 each for two children per week, which is £1,456 a year. Now, the Child Poverty Action Group estimates that to take a child up to 20 years would cost £190,000 for a family on average. Now, the child benefit amounts to, over 20 years, £29,000. £29,000 doesn't make much of a dent in £190,000. So is it that the child benefit is not remotely enough to cover the costs, and that is what is putting people off?
Well, I don't think the government or the state, and this is a political point, should be responsible for the costs of bringing up children. I think parents have to take that responsibility. But at the same time, if we want any kind of economy in the future, we have to find a way for people to have more children. Now, it just doesn't make sense that as we are one of the wealthiest countries in the world, we're as wealthy as we've ever been, even if our wealth isn't growing, that we cannot afford to have children when we're so much wealthier than our grandparents, our great-grandparents, who had so many more children. And I think in order to increase the birth rate, much more radical steps need to be taken. For example, and I've said this before, I think the whole tax system needs to conform with the tax system, say, of France or many other countries, where you get tax relief if you have children. And if that has to be funded by people without children paying more tax because we've got a terrible deficit, then so be it. We need to rebalance the whole state, the whole welfare system, both tax and benefits, to encourage people to have more children. Otherwise, the whole state, the whole economy, and the whole welfare state, first of all, the government's finances, are simply not going to function as we have more and more old people and fewer young workers.
But that rather goes against what you were saying earlier, that you don't believe that the state should intervene and pay their costs by giving them a tax deduction, which would then be made up by other people who don't have children. That is the state intervening and helping them, surely.
I think there are two separate points. Can the state make sure that every child has a basic welfare and a basic safety net? Yes. Can the state provide for every child to escape from what we now call relative poverty? Possibly not. But we can still put in place incentives to encourage people to have more children. That doesn't mean that the state can say, we will guarantee that no child will ever go short of anything. It doesn't mean that the state can absolutely provide a certainty that a child won't be in relative poverty. But generally, across society, the state should be changing the rules so that people are more likely to have children for financial reasons, both at the bottom end and at the top end, and putting all sorts of other measures in place to encourage people to have larger families. It's not just about money, it's about signals, it's about culture. We have a prime minister who said, the first prime minister who's spoken about this problem after 50 years of us having too few children, and what's he had to say? Nothing to do with me. I'm not going to force people to have children. Well, no one's talking about forcing anyone or anything, but the government could at least be sending out positive signals that this is an issue, that they wish to encourage people to have more children. This isn't just about child poverty.
And you mentioned the top end of the earnings scale. I mean, the benefit is means tested at the moment. Parents earning over $50,000 a year get little or nothing. But, and this may be somewhat contentious, but presumably the higher the earnings, on average, the more intelligent the parents. So let me just finish.
Sure, sorry, forgive me.
Should those higher earners be incentivized by removing the cutoff?
I don't ever want to talk about quality versus quantity. I think we need to have more children. And the idea that you're specifically going to encourage the more intelligent to have them more than the less intelligent, say, or the better off more than the worse off, and those two things aren't exactly the same, is repugnant. But at the same time, if you are going to incentivize wealthier people as well as poorer people, then doing it through the tax system means that you actually recognize that for a better off person, a tax break may be more of an incentive than a flat baby bonus or a flat child benefit. So it actually scales things up for a wealthier person who then has more tax relief, and it actually means more to them, and they're more likely to have children. Not because I want wealthy people to have more children and poorer people to have fewer. I want everybody to have more. But the incentive has to be different if it's going to make a difference at the top of the earnings scale.
At the University of Oxford last year put out a report that said that with fertility in the UK now about 1.6, it depends on which countries you include. I think with England and Wales it's about 1.5, which is not a replacement level of births. And it's partly, they said, driven by people choosing to have fewer children, but there's a disparity in how many children people want and how many they go on to have, and they call that the fertility gap. What's behind that?
Well, people say they want 2 to 3 children, and that's a fairly consistent thing across time in Britain and across most of the developed world. Most men and most women will say they want 2 to 3. But they don't end up having 2 to 3, they end up having 1 to 2, and fewer than 1.5 on average, or around 1.5 on average. And what that's about is that people don't always get what they want, and they don't always meet their own goals. And that, to me, is about prioritization. So if you say you want 2 to 3, but you're not having it, it's because other things are intervening. There are obstacles in your way which government and society could take out of your way, and there are other priorities you have. You may say you want 2 to 3 children, but are you prepared to make the sacrifices? And that's where it's not only about material incentives, it's also about changing the whole nature of the conversation and the whole culture in the UK, so that having children at a relatively early age, because I think people leave it too long, and that's another discussion, but having children, being parents, and embracing the family becomes the most important and exciting, and if you like, cool thing you can do. Whereas at the moment, people say, well, I'd like to have 2 to 3, but I've got too many other things to do, too many other priorities, and I'm not getting enough encouragement, I'm not getting enough incentive, I'm not getting enough support from the state.
Might it also be that at a young age, you're quite starry-eyed about the prospect of having children, and you have your first one, and then you reevaluate your life based on the potential nightmare that you've just gone through and the upending of your life, and you think, well, maybe not 3, maybe I'll just stop at 2 or 1.
Well, of course, that's bound to be the case for some people, and some people do have very difficult children and many, many sleepless nights. But for others, maybe they take the challenge, they have the first child, and then they find it's the most wonderful and exciting experience that they could ever imagine, and they're very keen to have a second and maybe a third. So, you know, I think part of the problem is for people to depict to those who are not parents that parenthood is nothing but sleepless nights and dirty nappies. Of course it's those things, but it's a lot of wonderful other things as well, and those wonderful other things have to be communicated and out there in the general culture as people make their decisions and choices.
What's the reason for the disparity between the birth rate between the developed world and the developing world?
Well, it's always been the case that as people get more urban, more wealthy and more educated, they take control of their fertility and they have other things to do with their lives, particularly as women get educated and they don't have 6 or 7 children. They can control that. They can understand how to use birth control. They have access to it. And with education, they're more likely to bring children into the world who they want to educate and maybe have a slightly smaller family. That's all very healthy and natural and good. The question is, when you get wealthy and urban and educated, do you have 2 to 3 children on average as a society, or do you have 1 or even less than 1 as in South Korea? So there's a general progression from very, very high fertility, also people have high infant mortality at that point, to a lower fertility rate. The question is, where do you stop? Do you keep going down below 2, below 1? And what are the serious social consequences of that? So I think the challenge is we've moved through that so-called demographic transition. We're out of the woods. We're out of a world where people can't control their own fertility, where they have no choices. When we have those choices, when we've moved out of that choiceless world, what do we choose to do? And it's extraordinary, actually. A lot of people don't realize that now even quite poor countries have very low fertility rates. So China, which isn't that rich, although it's getting richer, has barely one child per woman. Jamaica and Thailand, for example, have lower fertility rates than the UK. So even the fact, even the old, in the old days, poor countries had high fertility. The low fertility bug, if you like, the low fertility virus is spreading into poorer and poorer countries. It's no longer the case that all poor countries have big families.
Does the environment have a factor on people's ability to have children? I'm thinking about pollutants, plastics, forever chemicals and so on. Do they lead to fewer pregnancies?
I think the fear of global warming and the fear of environmental damage may put people off having children. But objectively, at any given age, as far as we know, the best data we have suggests it is not more difficult today to have a child, say at 28 or 32 or 35, than it was 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So if there is a biological component in people having smaller families, it's a very small one. Yes, part of it's people leaving it longer and longer, and of course your fertility declines. But at any given age, there's very little evidence, as far as I know, that it's harder to have a child biologically than it ever was. So if we're into an era of very low fertility, this is really social, maybe an economic, but not a biological problem.
Outside of economic inducements, is there anything else that we can do that we're not at the moment to create a more supportive environment for couples to have children?
Well, I think there are a whole range of things. I think celebrities should talk more about the joys of parenting. I think the government could send signals. I mean, just saying it's a good thing for people to have larger families than they do at the moment, rather than nothing to do with me, mate. If people could actually understand better how their fertility declines in their 30s, from 30 to 35 to 40, they might model their lives differently. We could encourage people to have their education perhaps at a later stage, have their children first, maybe subsidize their education if they're already parents. I mean, there's a whole range of things we could do. Something I do, which is be a very active grandparent, make your children's lives a little easier as they become parents, and so encourage them to have that extra child. I mean, there are 101 things we could do that we're not doing. We could design our products differently so that you don't need an extra big car to have three car seats in the back. There are many, many other things than just setting the level of child benefit. And if we want to have a society, an economy, a welfare state, a country, a nation, communities in 20, 30, 40 years' time, we're not going to manage to do that with the current birth rate.
And what about the provision of daycare, which is phenomenally expensive in this country? There's also making work compatible with being a parent, which seems to be an issue with some people, parental leave, those sort of things.
Yes, there's. I mean, we haven't mentioned housing, of course. That's an incredibly important one, which I'm pleased to say the government is at least trying to do something about, to change the regulations to make more family housing available and affordable. If it's built, the supply will grow. That's very important. Changes to the way we do childcare, a loosening of the regulations is probably going to make it cheaper and encourage people to have more children if they want to go back into the workplace, which is absolutely necessary for most people. So, yes, there are many, many different things we could do. And I think we've got to take a very holistic approach. It's not just, as I said, it's not just about child benefit. I mean, for example, a lot of firms are talking about how many days you have to work in the office. You know, is it 2 days? Is it 3 days? Is it 5 days? And I appreciate a lot of people don't have the luxury of working in jobs that they can work from home, but a lot of people do. So why not make the rules slightly more liberal if you have a family, because you can get to the childcare facility, pick the kids up from school, you have a more flexible life. So if it's 3 days in the office or 4 days, maybe it should be 2 days or 3 days for parents of young children. Maybe you could have more creches in workplaces and tax benefits for that. There are many different approaches that could be taken, and there are many different approaches that different countries are trying, because, of course, Britain is far from alone in having this problem.
And it's a problem, but it's perhaps bigger than we've been alluding to. Am I right in thinking that the population replacement rate is just over 2 children per couple, but it's running at about 1.5 children? So what happens if that continues? Is it a slow extinction of the human race?
Well, first of all, it's not just that it's 1.4 or 1.5 in Britain, but it's going down. And it's going down just across pretty much all the developed world and much of the developing world. I don't believe that we will ever go extinct. I think some group of people will be having children, some country, some nation, some religious group. So I don't think we'll go extinct. But I think the problem is that as this goes on, you get a sort of population pyramid that's upside down. Everything in our economy and our welfare state is based around the fact that you have a relatively small number of older people supported by a large number of working age people. The ratio of, say, 20 to 65-year-olds to those over 65. Of course, you can move the retirement date a bit, but there's a limit to what you can do there. Now, that ratio, we used to have 5-6 workers for every retiree, and now we're at about 3. Japan's down to about 2. So if this carries on, you just get an older and older population. And I think what will fall apart is our societal ability to give support, and that will manifest itself through, for example, the government simply not being able to fund the kind of welfare state that we're used to, the kind of pensions that people expect, the kind of health care. An 85-year-old requires 6-7 times as much health spend as a 20, 30, 40-year-old. So all the things that we've come to expect as a civilized society will be simply unaffordable with the kind of demography that we're heading into.
And in that scenario, is immigration the only thing that can save us?
Well, I think a rise in the birth rate can save us, so immigration certainly isn't the only thing. And immigration has all sorts of limitations. First of all, not everybody embraces it, and there's political backlash. People vote against it. We live in democracies, so we can't just assume it will go on forever. Secondly, immigrants age. Immigrants see their fertility rates fall. I mean, most of our immigrant groups in Britain don't have a materially higher fertility rate than the white British. So what you become is a Ponzi scheme where you bring in young people to do the work because you won't have them yourself. They get old, and then you have to bring more and more young people in. And also, of course, many of the places we traditionally got our immigrants from, Ireland, Poland, for example, they don't have very big families anymore. They're not poorer than us. In fact, Ireland, by some counts, is significantly richer. So the idea that we are in this luxurious position of not having to have our own children and being able to suck in the numerous 20-somethings of other countries is going to be seen as a sort of a historical abnormality that just doesn't apply anymore.
Good to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks very much for your time. Thanks. That's Dr. Paul Morland, demographer and author of No One Left, Why the World Needs More Children. So what do you make of that? It's quite a tough problem to fix, really. You can't force people to have children. But would increasing the number of children that are covered by the child benefit levels actually make a difference? If you have 2 children, would you be persuaded to have a third if the government increased the number of children that could receive this child benefit of £26.5? Well, that's the level for your first child. It goes down for your subsequent ones. But let's talk about that figure, £26 a week. Is that going to change your mind? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Imagine your dream holiday made possible by comparing cheap flights on Kayak. Walking on an unspoilt goes on for miles beach on the Sardinian coast. Plunging into the splendour of an idyllic lagoon in Greece. Ah, yes. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare prices from hundreds of travel sites and airlines to find your dream deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
I've had a few. Jimmy was my first. He was gorgeous and gave me so much space. Then there was Lorenzo. He was exciting, but also reliable. Elvis is my latest. I love him the most. He makes me feel so warm with his heated seats and steering wheel. It might sound strange to love a car and name them, but it's not just me. Almost every Honda Jazz owner stays with the Jazz and buys another. True love starts with a test drive. Honda, the power of dreams.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Talking about babies, a lack of them, the Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner has refused to confirm whether the government is planning to scrap the two-child benefit cap. That doesn't mean to say they aren't considering it, because it has been reported that Keir Starmer has backed abolishing the limit and asked the Treasury to find £3.5 billion down the back of the sofa in order to make that happen. A leaked memo from Angela Rayner's department appeared to urge the Chancellor to claw back child benefit payments from wealthier families, alongside several other suggestions. So the government seems to be at odds with each other, at least those two individuals are. I wonder if it would make any difference whatsoever if the government was to decide to make child benefit unlimited, not just for the first or second child, but for however many you like, and each child would get £26.05. I don't know why 5p, but let's say £26 per week per child. Is that going to make much of a difference? 0345 6060 973. And if you've delayed having children for whatever reason, I'd be interested to know what your reason is. Lewisham, hello Barry.
Hi Nick, good evening. Just a very quick correction. The child benefit is not limited. The child benefit you can get for as many children as. The cap applies to universal credit and child tax credits. It's actually £67 a week that you would get for an additional child. So the actual amount that's lost is much greater than is being stated as 20-odd. It's not 20-odd. So that's child benefit. So the universal credit is limited to two children. Now, that was done as part of welfare reform. David Cameron brought that in. And at the time, he told everyone, we've got too many children. Everyone's having too many kids. Have fewer children. So I remember the rhetoric. I remember the whole, Nick Clegg was part of it as well. I remember hearing them on the radio, on your very station.
That was incorrect information at the time, because we've had a declining birth rate since 2010, you're saying David Cameron said that. So that's not true.
No, well, that's exactly that. I actually phoned up at that time. I spoke to one of your presenters at the time, and I was making the very same point. We've got a declining birth rate, so we actually need children. A child benefit or paying for an additional child for universal credit is still an investment in the child, and the child is going to be part of the future. We require those children as part of the future. So it was a terrible, terrible piece of advice.
Well, unless am I wrong in thinking that child benefit is not attached to your receiving of universal credit? It's separate.
Totally separate.
Right, so that is correct then. What we're talking about is either having or not having £26.05 per week.
Oh, no, you'll get that anyway. You'll get that anyway. You'll get the £26 because
up to two children. That's what we're talking about. Yes, the cap starts at two children.
Yeah, the cap applies to universal credit, not child benefits. Child benefits is paid separately. And that's the one that's limited for 50 grand and blah, blah, blah. Universal credit is available to all fucking people, and it's limited to two children. So it's the universal credit that is actually limited. That was previously child tax credits. When the new Labour government brought in child tax credits and working tax credits in order to give people an incentive to have children and to make sure that they can afford things. That's what was done way back in the 90s. The Conservatives brought in welfare reform and universal credit and limited the benefits. Nick Ferrari knows well. He was part of it.
Nick Ferrari is not here at the moment.
I know.
I'm trying to get my head around this. Child benefit amounts to £26.5p each for two for your first child, down to about £17 for your second. We're getting bogged down in amounts here. It doesn't really make any difference. It doesn't, even at the higher level, it doesn't make much of a dent in the cost of raising a child to the age of 20, which is, so claimed the Child Poverty Action Group, £190,000 a year. Now, that is the kind of number that might put people off having children. But if if, say, people were given the same allowance as an MP, well, then they might make a different decision in their life, because that would certainly make raising a child more affordable. MPs are allowed, it's extraordinary, really, £5,435 for each of three children, not two. £5,435 for each of three children. Each, £108,000 over 20 years. Now, £108,000 certainly does make a dent in £190,000, and that might persuade couples that they could, make it work financially. But that's not what is being offered here. That deal is only available to MPs, not to ordinary people like you and me. So I wonder if the amount, considering the difficulty that we're facing, as the doctor described, we've got an upside-down pyramid. We've got a very few number of younger people who are economically active and supporting a much larger group of increasingly aging and ill people at the top. And that just doesn't work. And it's being seen in every country. Japan was the first country where this really started to become noticeable. But it's spread everywhere, apart from what some call the third world, developing countries. They're still having children at a level above the replacement rate. So something is either going to have to change. The government is going to have to make it more affordable to have children. It's going to have to make it easier to have children. Or we're going to have to get used to the fact that we're going to become older and sicker and poorer. But I guess that's a long-term thing, and politicians aren't very good at solving long-term problems. Thanks for that, Barry. 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts on this to come. But immediately after the news, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has alleged that the White House's silence after recent Russian attacks is encouraging President Putin, following Moscow's largest aerial attack yet. We'll cross to the US for analysis on that. Just past 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
It's emerged a man being detained by police investigating a house fire which killed three children and their mother is now being held under the Mental Health Act. Two other people were also injured at Stonebridge in northwest London on Saturday morning. Officials in Gaza say at least 30 people have been killed today by new Israeli strikes on the territory. It's thought they happened in Khan Yunis, Jabalia and Nusayrat, and the dead include a local journalist and a senior rescue service official. And a police officer who remains in a critical condition after being hit by a car while on duty is being named as PC Christopher Miller. The 38-year-old was seriously injured during a collision in the Stoke Poges part of Buckinghamshire on Thursday night. LBC weather, scattered showers continuing in northern and western areas with brisk winds as well. Drier in the south and the east, but still the chance of an odd shower. A low in the far north of 6 degrees.
This is LBC.
Wow, it's amazing how much salt is in our favourite foods. You might not be able to taste it, but you'd be surprised where salt pops up, like in sauces, soups and ready meals. Better Health Families has simple swaps for salty food and tips to keep food tasting great. To find out how much salt is too much, search Better Health Families.
At ulizprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulizprosperity.com.
Now, focus on your car. That's right, the one you're ready to sell. See it clearly in your mind, waiting to be sold. We can make it disappear. Just watch carefully. Your car, sold, collected and paid for in almost no time at all. Start selling your car today. It's not magic. It's Motorway. One day I'll fly
away. Amazon offers employees up to £8,000 for education and training. Like Juliet. She's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £8,000 for education and training at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
More of your thoughts on babies to come, but let's talk about Ukraine for just a moment. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has urged international leaders to increase their pressure on Russia after Moscow's forces intensified strikes on Ukraine. Let's talk about this with Malcolm Nance. Malcolm is a former US Navy intelligence officer who went to Ukraine and joined the Ukrainian army. Good evening, Malcolm.
Good evening.
Now, the EU have increased sanctions on Russia after a lack of concessions from Vladimir Putin. Sanctions haven't worked so far. Can more of the same work now?
Well, sanctions are designed to place pressure on the financial sector, on the internal economy. That has had an effect in Russia. The economy's in very bad shape. And of course, the strategic, place where they get most of their cash, which is oil and natural gas, have been crippled. Their banking internationally has been crippled. It's the sanctions busting, going through third countries, working with China, North Korea, other places that have made those sanctions a bit ineffective. But you have to constantly find and counterstep wherever Russia's evolving around that and make sure that it works. And this is where the trouble with the United States comes in. The question is, what are they going to do in the future that could thwart all of these sanctions?
It seems extraordinary, though, that there is still room for more sanctions. I mean, why haven't they been in place all along?
Well, you know, this is it's rather funny that out in the, in the West, in the Western Hemisphere, we are nations of laws and we can only impact certain things at certain times. Most of the sanctions were direct. I was certainly opposed and many people were opposed that the Biden administration and other countries weren't going after every individual and their families associated with, the Russian regime. There were lots of loopholes that just couldn't be fulfilled. Like, for example, many Russians go to the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, where they bring their cash. Many of these oligarchs bring their cash and they take like Sukuk banking and they take other forms of banking where, the UAE has replaced Switzerland for, going through those, creating those loopholes and getting their money out into the greater world and purchasing things. Also acquiring technologies that are used in their weapon system. So that makes it difficult. You just can't, it's sort of like whack-a-mole, right? You can't hit them all simultaneously.
So Russia's economy, as damaged as it has been, is that now primarily focused on provisions for war?
Well, you would think so. But, Russia isn't the Soviet Union. And even though they have, tried to centrally change their economy to do that, there are many things that are involved in the fundamentals of their economic system in which they need to make money. You can produce all the oil in the world, but if you can't transport it legally through, their Grey Ghost, fleet of ships that can get it out there, or by truck or pipeline out to China and Iran, other places that may be able to launder or purchase it at less than market prices, that's not going to help. The low cost that, the crashing price of a price of barrel, per barrel of oil is really hurting them to the point. I mean, look, in the United States, we're shutting down wells. In Russia, this is all they have. Same with natural gas. So, I mean, it's a cumulative effect. And we know that it's certainly having a big problem, just producing things for the average Russian. I mean, just flying on an airplane is one of the most dangerous things you can do because the sanctions cut off all the parts and resupply there. So I think it does have an effect. But, we're entering the fourth year of the war and Russia's a big nation. The question is, can they sustain or will it crack?
And given all that, to what extent do you think Vladimir Putin's position depends on continuing this war?
Well, for Putin, this is a, this is a psychological crisis. It's not an existential crisis the way it is for Volodymyr Zelensky and the people of Ukraine. And I know, I serve with them and they're just mortified. But, Ukraine is not losing this war. I mean, Russia is making advances by the kilometer, but they have to lose 10,000, 20,000 men dead to get those few kilometers. For Putin, he views it, and look, this is a guy who was an old KGB communist officer. His father, I believe, was a cook for Stalin. He has a Stalinist view of the world. He thinks that his money is doing the talking, but he feels that he must take Ukraine. It's folly. He hasn't taken anything other than a few percent of the country and what he seized in 2014 in Donbass, Luhansk, and Crimea, which he did by surprise. He can't win this war. He just hasn't realized it yet.
How extensive is the damage to Ukraine? I mean, we've seen the pictures of, the drone attacks and so on, but it's difficult to get a sense of how widespread the damage is.
Yeah, and this is where I think that Donald Trump and his administration are playing a horrible propaganda game which favors Russia. I've lived in Ukraine. I served in the Ukrainian army for 10 months. My friends and good comrades are still there in Kharkiv and Kyiv and other places. Look, Russia occupies, if Ukraine is 18 hours long, if you were to drive at 150 kilometers per hour, it would take you 18 hours to cross it from the Polish border to the Russian border. The war is in that last 30 to 45 minutes of the drive, and only in the southeastern border areas where they're trying to advance from their lines that they took in 2014. Ukraine is not destroyed. I mean, you would have to hunt for damage. But yes, do drones hit commercial residential areas? Yes. In the city of Kharkiv, where I lived for almost 10 months, the city is so efficient. Firefighters put out the fire. The city would remove the debris. You would have to hunt for where they actually hit debris there. But city of Kyiv is a city of 5 million people. It's Chicago size. And they lost 4 dead and 12 injured yesterday. So we hear about these things, and when you put it into, I mean, this is nothing like the Blitz, right? In London, or, you know, Coventry, or, we get these impressions that they are. If you were in Ukraine, the only thing you would hear is air raid sirens and maybe the occasional bang from air defense. If you lived in Kyiv yesterday, this is one of the greatest blitzes on the city, and still minimal impact. But for the people who have to live in a bunker at night with their kids, it's terrifying. And that's what Putin wants. These attacks are really demonstration attacks in order to harass the population. They're never going to break, though.
Do you think that there's a way that Putin would take the off-ramp from this other than total victory? Is that the only thing that's going to satisfy him?
Yeah, I think, again, this is a psychological battle which is being waged inside Vladimir Putin's head. You know, when I wrote my third book about the Trump-Putin relationship, it was called The Plot to Betray America, I went to his office in Dresden when he was a KGB officer. And this guy was a human manipulator. His other KGB officers just wanted to eat schnitzel and sausage and drink beer when they were in East Germany. He wanted to flip people. He sees Ukraine as a strategic asset to rebalance the Warsaw Pact, right? What the pride of the Soviet Union. It's also 25%, one quarter of the world's wheat in one country. Also, they had all their advanced technologies of missile systems, ships engineering for the Soviet Union was all built in Ukraine. So Putin has this, you know, imperialistic view that he's going to take this place back. He's never going to take it. Those people, 42 million people, they're adaptive. They have guts. They're Cossacks, and they will fight to the death. And the fact that he couldn't get more than a fraction of that country and lost most of his advances from 2022, literally having entire armies eliminated, he's living in a fantasy life.
Do we know how this is playing in Russia? I mean, its citizens might not be fully informed, but they must have noticed a lack of young men in their communities.
Well, they have, you know, and that's why, you know, Russia is pumping out the propaganda. The thing that I think that the Russian people are noticing more is not the lack of, you know, whether they have access to Hershey's chocolate bars or Cadbury or something like that, right? The luxury goods from the West. It's the fact that the war is coming to Russia now. I mean, tonight out of Sheremetyevo Airport, every government aircraft that was of any value took off and went east because they saw the blitz of Ukrainian drones coming. There is no pretending this war is not there in the major cities of Russia. Things are blowing up. Factories are exploding. The Kremlin itself has been hit. I think the Russian people, since they have no liberty, no democracy, there's nothing they can do. And a lot of them are used to going back to that mindset of the Soviet Union. But I don't think that the Russian people's heart is in this war. And I think a lot of people, when they see, you know, we've seen attacks on Russian veterans who have come back, physical attacks, you know, I think they would rather this all end. But it's never going to end so long as Putin's alive.
You mentioned Trump a couple of times. He must have said 100 times over that he would stop the war on day one. Putin appears to have no respect for him at all, despite Trump's apparent belief that he does. And yet Trump seems to be favoring Russia. Is that a misperception on my part?
Not at all. I've written four books about this, four New York Times bestsellers about Trump and Russia's relationship. And it is absolutely bizarre. Donald Trump is about Donald Trump. He's now rated the worst president in American history. But since he's regained power by winning by, you know, 0.5%, which was all it took, he is living in a world where he feels he's master of the universe. And he has had a deep, bizarre relationship with Moscow that goes back to 1977. I mean, he went to the Soviet Union in 1987 to try to get a Trump Tower in Moscow. He married two women who were from behind the Iron Curtain. He views that hardcore autocratic dictatorial style of Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un and Xi of China as things to admire. He is not a he does not believe in the American form of democracy that we exported around the world since the founding of the United States, and certainly since we landed in Normandy 1944. He embraces a form of fascism. So he views himself as one of the three leaders of the world who are going to re-engineer it, giving Putin Europe, giving the United States the Western Hemisphere, and China Asia, which I refer to as an axis of autocrats. But there's another part of this. Trump is looking out for, he sees Russia as a ginormous pot of hundreds of billions of untapped dollars because of sanctions. And everything he is doing, even his communications with Putin, is leaning in to raise sanctions and to get access to that sweet, sweet Moscow money.
And just finally, Russia keeps threatening the UK with Armageddon. What do you make of those threats?
Yeah, okay. Obviously, this is again, that Cold War mindset that Putin has. I mean, I've watched for almost 3 years nonstop, every day now, Putin's, you know, talking head, Soloviev, you know, Maria Butina, and, you know, Olga Skabeva sit there on Russian state TV and talk about, we're going to send the Sarmat missile to Britain and obliterate London. Does this, it's a fantasy in the sense that, first off, it's mutually assured destruction, right? You have the Trident D4 missile system. Does he not know one of your ballistic missile carrying submarines? He does, right? This is all propaganda aimed at peaceniks in your country, whoever they are, right? Because maybe he thinks this is the 1980s and that you're all going to start protesting, you know, up at the, you know, Inverness, Scotland at the sub bases. He lives in a fantasy world there. You have the capacity to your country alone to literally obliterate Russia and end the world. So why he keeps doing this propaganda is literally laughable, because there's no one in England paying attention to this other than you and me, perhaps.
Well, good to end on a positive note. Thanks very much for that. Malcolm Nance, former U.S. Navy intelligence officer who went to Ukraine and joined the Ukraine army. Thank you, Malcolm.
Cheers.
This is LBC. Back to your thoughts about our declining birth rate and what we can do about it in just a moment.
LBC, coming up next week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, a Labour government that's got problems with the workers. First the bins. Then the health service.
What do you want?
And don't forget the classrooms and the teachers.
Teachers, where are they?
Left their job because of pay.
The Prime Minister did promise change, but is the country heading for a summer of discontent? Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back Tuesday morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
Hey, it's me, the washing machine. Look, sorry about the noise last night. I'll try and keep a lid on the old drum and bass, yeah? Cheers. I've used a bit more energy than usual. But your hoodie smells like clouds, so...
Heads up! I'm going to be buzzing for the next hour!
Need to conquer the power hungry? With OVO, you can choose 2 hours of free electricity a week. OVO. Do energy differently. Beyond customers only. Smart meter required. Payable as energy credit. Consumption limit of 1 kilowatt per hour. 3 hours ends August 31st. T's and C's apply.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Fanning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable, and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Fanningdental.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
There seems to be three existential threats to humankind. There's probably more, but I can think of three off the top of my head. One is climate change. One is global thermonuclear war. And one is not having enough sex to have babies, specifically. And we are on a path, like a slow path, to extinction if this continues unabated, because we are not producing enough babies to replace the people that die of old age. Or any other factor. And I wonder if there's anything that the government can do about it outside of forcing people to have children. 0345 6060 973. Sevenoaks, hello Mark.
Hi, I'd like to first of all thank Malcolm for his service and his attitude. But your previous guest, I think, lacked something in his analysis. He's talking about providing babies now for the workforce in 2 decades' time. But we're already looking at the increase of artificial intelligence that will take away jobs. So it's very far from clear that we will need the people to fill jobs that he's talking about producing.
Mm.
But the worrying thing is that he didn't even discuss that. It doesn't seem to even come onto his radar.
Well, it's very difficult to know what's going to happen, because other technological advances that people thought were going to wipe out millions of jobs actually provided more jobs. They were just different ones that they hadn't conceived of before the technological advance had actually taken place. So this may be different this time around. I suspect that it will be, but it is also possible that the jobs that are lost in one area will be gained in another.
Well, I'm not saying that it isn't possible. I agree with you that this is that it's likely we'll need less work. But the point is, he didn't even consider it in his calculations. It seems that the discussions, there seem to be two discussions: one, people who are afraid of a low birth rate; the other, people who are afraid of the birth rate being too high, effectively, because of the possibility of artificial intelligence. But it doesn't appear that those discussions are in any way linked. People don't seem to try to come to any conclusion as to what the balance is. And as such, that, I think that means the discussions are deeply flawed. I mean,
well, yes, but again, it's very difficult to base a plan or an argument on something that we don't know, on an unknown. I mean, the amount of jobs that we'll be required to do in 20 years' time after the advancement of AI and so on and robot technology, we've got no idea. So let's deal with what we're looking at now. And perhaps when things become more clear, then we can address the advance of technology then.
Well, we're not going to lose that many people in terms of the population size in a few years, but perhaps we should consider the thing a bit later, because after all, if we produce loads of people now, those people will be in the job market, or possibly in the job market in 2 decades' time, and we won't be able to go back on that decision. I know that we can't know for certain what's going to happen, but the best way of discussing the matter is not simply to ignore it entirely and put on blinkers.
Right, because in the future we might actually benefit from fewer people. That's what you're saying. But again, we don't know, so it's difficult to make an argument one way or the other based on that unknown. But good to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for that. Manchester. Hello, Stephen.
How you doing, mate? You all right?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Just the Royal Navy about 2 weeks ago, so if you go on royalnavy.org, we shot down a supersonic missile for the first time. It's not been done before, so I'm not worried about the Russians. We've got Trident. I know the last time we tested Trident, it went about 200 feet up in the air and nearly landed on
there. Well, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Will it work? Dead. Will it work when somebody presses the big red button, Mark, go?
I do believe the Americans and British will have done something about that. I just think when they're threatening us all the time, look, we have tried. I think your previous guest said, look, just our ballistic missile system alone could finish Russia off. So
yeah, I just wonder if when it came down to it, we would actually launch a barrage of missiles that would spell the end of the world.
Can you imagine Keir Starmer saying he's going to launch ballistic missiles?
Well, I find it difficult to think of anybody in possession of their senses that would actually occasion that. That's, to me, is the fundamental problem with the ultimate deterrent, is that would we actually use it and under what circumstances? But thanks for that, Stephen. Richmond, Chloe.
Hello.
Chloe.
Hello. I just pulled down the ONS UK population figures projection for the next 100 years.
Yeah.
And by 2115, we're projected to have 120 million people in this country.
Right. If this current trajectory continues.
Yeah. Because they make assumptions, and these are updated all the time, and nobody knows what's going to happen, wars and pandemics and all the rest of it.
But does that include the current level of immigration, though?
Yeah, it has.
Right,
okay. It has projections for mortality, fertility, cross-border rates, birth deaths, migration, international migration, blah, 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 blah,
right,
blah. And based on all of the above, in 100 years' time, we'll have twice as many people in this country as we have now.
Yeah, but that's a very difficult number to actually base any reliable argument on, though, because, you know, things, particularly immigration, is changing all the time, and we've had a record immigration in the last, 10 or 20 years.
Absolutely, but on the basis of the projections of the data that they can accurately assess right now, they're saying there'll be twice as many of us in 100 years' time.
Yeah, but again, if things continue as they are, but it seems unlikely that they will, considering what a hot topic immigration is, so that would certainly change the numbers that you're talking about. But I understand what you're saying, that perhaps we need to have fewer babies, not more. But that doesn't solve the problem, that sort of upside-down pyramid. We'll have a small number of people who are economically active, taking care of, or literally taking care of, but also making the money that would provide the care of a vast number of people who are increasingly old and ill and requiring ever more expensive medical interventions. So I'm not sure fewer babies is actually in our interests, and we'll perhaps have to take that figure that they come up with a pinch of salt. But thanks for that, Chloe. I'll give you the last word on that. Now, in the next hour, a new dawn for Britain's railways is hailed by ministers as the first nationalised train services under the Labour government started operating earlier today. Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander said, "We are moving away from 30 years of inefficiency, delayed services and failing passengers, and moving confidently into a new era, the era of Great British Railways." However, the first SWR service, the 536 from Woking to Waterloo, was hit by a bank holiday engineering works, resulting in a rail replacement bus. So what does the renationalisation mean to you? Is it a new dawn, a new age of the train? And where should the Labour government place renationalisation on their list of priorities? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. A man arrested over a house fire in northwest London where a mother and three of her children died is now being held under the Mental Health Act. Police have also named the victims, as LBC's Tom Harrigan now reports.
Crews were called to the fire in Stonebridge early yesterday morning. Nusrat Usman, who was 43, died at the scene, as did her 15-year-old daughter Mariam and two sons, Musa, who was 8, and 4-year-old Rais. A 13-year-old girl remains in a critical condition in hospital. A woman in her 70s has now been released. Detectives say the 41-year-old man taken into custody in connection with the fire was bailed, then detained under mental health legislation.
A dual US and German citizen has been arrested on charges he travelled to Israel and tried to firebomb the Tel Aviv branch of the US embassy. Prosecutors in New York say Joseph Neumeier went to the building on the 19th of May with a backpack containing petrol bombs. Israeli officials deported him to New York on Saturday. President Zelensky of Ukraine has warned Washington's silence over the latest Russian airstrikes on his country is encouraging Vladimir Putin. Officials say at least 12 people, including three children, were killed, while dozens more were injured. Russia claims to have intercepted more than 100 Ukrainian drones this weekend. But the former US Navy intelligence officer, Malcolm Nance, has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC, Kyiv is remaining strong.
Ukraine is not losing this war. I mean, Russia is making advances by the kilometer, but they have to lose 10,000, 20,000 men dead to get those few kilometers. For Putin, he feels that he must take Ukraine. It's folly. He hasn't taken anything other than a few percent.
A 29-year-old man has been charged after a crossbow was carried into a hospital in Glasgow. Specialist firearms officers were sent to the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital on Friday. Police have confirmed the weapon wasn't fired. And in sport and in rugby league, Salford are still rooted to the bottom of Rugby League's Super League table. After being thrashed 72-10 at Wakefield, they currently have just one win from their opening 12 games. LBC weather, scattered showers continuing in the north and the west with brisk winds overnight. Drier for the south and the east, but there'll still be a chance of a shower. There'll be a low in the far north of around 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The first departure from Waterloo under the newly renationalised South Western Railway has taken place. The train bears the logo of Great British Railways, the organisation that the government plans to create to run almost all of the rail services in England, Wales and Scotland. Let's talk about the changes that this presages with John Bosco Nuobo, lead campaigner of We Own It, a group campaigning for public ownership. Good evening, John Bosco.
Good evening, Nick.
So the organisation Great British Railways is with us. What is it and what will it do?
Well, it's in essence what the government is calling a guiding mind. It's going to bring together what right now under privatization are several, I believe around 11 or more actually, different rail operators, bring them all under public ownership under the auspices of Great British Railway so that it is coordinated from a central place.
And how will the public notice that anything has changed?
Well, that's a really important thing for kind of to colour some of the discussion today. Obviously, the expectation is that public ownership is going to improve things. And it's important to make the point that the railway under public ownership now has a much better chance of being improved. You remember that under privatization, what we had was, in essence, several tens of chefs in the kitchen, each of whom are fighting over the profits for their shareholders, and none of whom cares very much about what happens to passengers. Now, what's going to happen is that from a purely systemic point of view, the whole system is designed to care for the experience of the passenger. Now, that doesn't automatically mean that things will improve or even improve drastically. The government still needs to get public ownership right. And part of that is essentially making sure that there are no longer private incentives within the railway system that are driving the system in its own direction as opposed to all driving in the same direction.
Was it always going to fail, nationalisation? Because they weren't, the train companies weren't really competing with each other at all. They were just gifted various monopolies, weren't they? If you wanted to go from London to North Wales, for instance, you didn't have a choice of train companies. There was no competition between them. You had only one company.
Absolutely. So that's why it doesn't make sense that it's privately run, right? It's a monopoly to begin with. It's a bit like Thames Water or your water company. You don't have a choice as to which one you use. You show up on the platform and get on the train that's available. So it's a natural monopoly in that respect, which means the idea that competition would make the service run better was always doomed to failure from the start. And obviously what we have seen over the last 30 years is that failure materializing and the government realizing, well, it's time to take this problem, to grab this this problem by the horns and deal with it.
Is there any evidence to suggest that the railways used to be providing a better service before nationalisation? Because I seem to recall, I mean, it was a long time ago now, but there was no end of people complaining about the trains before and after nationalisation.
You said before nationalisation, I think you meant before privatisation.
Privatisation, yeah, you're quite
that's
right.
That's correct.
That's right.
And something that's really important to keep in mind is obviously that part of what was the problem with British Rail, as it was known then, was that the government didn't really invest as much as it needed to invest into the system then. And that's part of what we are saying. In order to get public ownership right, not taking it into public ownership is not 100% of the equation. Investment is part of that. And the best railway system in Europe, some of your viewers may know, is Switzerland. And Switzerland is entirely 100% publicly owned. And the reason why it can be successful in public ownership are two reasons, actually. One is that it's not fragmented, so you can essentially guide the entire system from top to bottom. And as you mentioned, it's a monopoly, so there's no need for all the fragmentation within it. And the second thing is, obviously, the fact that there is no longer private interest taking out billions of pounds. For example, the RMT research showed that the private companies, private rail companies, were taking out about £1 billion in dividends every single year. That's an important amount of money that will now stay in the system as a result of public ownership. And that's what we have an opportunity to create with taking the rail into public ownership.
And will there be a benefit in running both, in one organisation, running both the tracks and the trains?
That's the expectation, right? Because obviously, at the moment, Network Rail that runs track has to negotiate almost everything it does with private companies that have a different set of interests than it does, than Network Rail does, right? So if everything is now under one roof and it's each aspect of the rail system is coordinating with another aspect of the rail system, something that passengers always talk about, and I experienced this recently actually, is the fact that if you get on one train, or if you have a connecting train from, say, Oxford to somewhere in Brighton, and so you're going from Oxford to Paddington and then from Paddington to Brighton, if your train in Oxford is delayed, which means you arrive late in Paddington, there is nothing that requires the train from Paddington to Brighton to wait for that train that you took from Oxford. Mm. So essentially coordinating the entire system is one of the really, really valuable benefits of taking the entire railway system into public ownership.
And yet the train operators will still be private contractors, won't they? There'll be private contractors working under the sort of leadership of the government employees. So why privatize a bit and not all of it?
So the train operators are going to be private until the last one will be in private hands until 2027, I believe. So they're gradually being taken into public ownership. And the reason the government has done it that way is that it doesn't want to pay out any money to the private operators in order to buy them out of their contracts. So it's allowing their contracts to expire, and it's taking them into public hands gradually. But something else, another aspect of the rail system, which you may have been referring to, is the open access aspect of the railway system. So there are some private rail companies, Lumo, for example, that run rail services on track capacity that is left available by the mainline train operators. Those are, the government wants to retain that private capacity within the railway system, even under public ownership. And that has the potential to create big problems for the government being able to achieve the benefits of public ownership. Because one of the things that you need to be able to do, as I mentioned earlier on, is coordinate your timetable, to coordinate everything within that system. And having private operators within it kind of cuts against it in a way that, in some ways, somebody described the railway system as almost addicted to chaos. And that's what they would be bringing, that chaos in the system.
Mm. Also, there are people who are working in the railways who will still be working for other companies. The privatisation is being reversed, yet many jobs on the railways will still be outsourced. Why aren't they being taken in-house?
That's a really good question, and absolutely they should be taken into public hands for a number of reasons. Obviously, workers have better terms and conditions under public authorities more so than they do under private companies, and that has an impact on the experience that passengers have on the railway system. People like to talk about workers' issues as though they're workers' issues and then passengers' issues, but if you treat the workers well, passengers benefit from that as well. So it's really important that those jobs, whether they're jobs cleaning train stations or cleaning trains or doing other things at train stations, because those are mainly the kinds of jobs that are currently privatized outside of the rail operators. Those jobs need to be brought into public ownership. Those workers need to be treated well and paid what they've earned.
And do you foresee a future when the rail industry is going to be flush with cash? Because if privately run companies got into financial difficulties, what confidence can we have that the service run by the government won't collapse?
Well, the government currently, even under public private control, under privatization, the government guarantees the railway system, right? You remember that during the pandemic, when passenger numbers crashed, the government basically paid up everything to the private companies. They just got free money from the government. So the government, in essence, because it is the government, is able to guarantee ensuring that the railway system runs because it is beneficial for the economy. Something that people don't know is that every single pound that the government puts into the railway system generates about £2.5 of economic activity in the British economy, right? So the government will always have enough money to put into a railway system, because that money develops or generates economic activity for the country.
Now, the group that you are a lead campaigner of, We Own It, is not just interested in the railway industry. You're also very much engaged with the NHS and the water industry, and specifically on the latter. Has the privatisation of our water industry got echoes in the failure of the privatisation of trains?
Well, that's a really, really important question. You mentioned earlier on the fact that rail is a natural monopoly in some sense. Where we have the most perfect natural monopoly is actually in water, because obviously you only have one set of pipes running water into your house, and you can't just switch from company to company for that water. So you are stuck with that one water company. And what private water shareholders have done over the period of privatization is take tens of billions of pounds out of those companies in dividend payments. They've taken around 60 billion pounds out in dividend payments and kind of loaded up those companies with more than 70 billion pounds worth of debt. And what companies like Thames Water and Southern Water are experiencing right now are, in essence, the chicken coming back to roost. They're paying for extracting value from these companies. And part of the reason why that's kind of happening, and somehow we should have expected this, is that they don't quite care about the purpose of this thing. The purpose of this thing is a public service. It's part of why we are a civilization. It's the way we keep ourselves going as a civilization. We tick along by having good sanitation, by having good cleaning water. And that's the job of the water companies. But they have kind of kidnapped that service and made it a cash cow. And it's time that we get our water back into public ownership.
Yeah, what would be the difficulties in doing that? It seems odd. We are the only country in the world, as far as I'm aware, that has sold off all of its water industry. But what would be the difficulties in taking it back?
So I should start by saying that you're absolutely right. We are the only country in the world that has sold off the water infrastructure, but also the running of the water itself. There are some countries where the water infrastructure is publicly owned, but the water itself is run by a private company. And I think an example of that is Chile, if I'm not mistaken. But there are very few of those. The vast majority of countries in the world, including the majority of states in the United States of America, the majority of municipalities run their water, own and run their water in public hands. And the reason why it seems to be difficult for the government, obviously, the vast majority of the public, more than 8 in 10 of us, believe that water should be in public hands. And for the public, it seems to be a no-brainer. And it is a no-brainer. The reason the government has been giving for why they're not doing it is, in essence, that it is too expensive to do it. But they keep quoting a figure of £100 billion to say that it's too expensive to do it. The reality is that, and even pro-privatization academics have called this out, they're referring to a figure that was produced by a piece of research that was funded by the water companies. And The Guardian has called this out as well. So it's really important that the government, if they want to be honest about fixing the water crisis, and they continue to kind of role play a government that wants to fix the water crisis with what they're doing with bonuses, for example, that's not going to make a difference. If you want to really make a difference in the crisis in our water, you have to talk about ownership. At this moment, the ownership model of our water is not working. There is a reason why nobody else does it the way we do it. Scotland, in the United Kingdom, Scotland has their water in public hands, and they're not in this crisis that we find ourselves in. There is a reason that's happening, and privatization is that reason.
Very good to talk to you, John Bosco. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
John Bosco Nuovo, lead campaigner of We Own It. So what do you make of that? Because it's, as we were talking about, it's not the only industry that people are calling to be renationalised, water being the other one. It seems both industries seem to have been failed, really, by the process of privatisation, or we, the poor dopes who pay taxes, we have been failed by that privatisation, and the railways have been taken back into public hands. Why not the water industry too? And are you glad that the railways are being taken back under government control, or are you concerned that the government has not demonstrated its ability to run a bath, let alone a national rail service? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Wow! It's amazing how much salt is in our favourite foods. You might not be able to taste it, but you'd be surprised where salt pops up. Like in sauces, soups and ready meals. Better Health Families has simple swaps for salty food and tips to keep food tasting great. To find out how much salt is too much, search Better Health Families.
Tired of watching your uninvested cash do nothing? With the Bank of England base rate reducing, investment platform IG is doing something extraordinary. IG is offering a whopping 8.5% AER variable on all uninvested cash. Yes, 8.5%. Just open an account, transfer money in and make one investment before May 31st to unlock this incredible rate. Visit IG.com now to open an investment account today. Your capital is at risk. GIA, ISA and SIPP accounts only. Boosted rate applies until 31st August 2025. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we have a newly renationalised South Western Railway. The nationalised rail operation will have the same timetable, the same fares and the same staff as the current private operator. And they've released a statement. South Western Railway said in a message to its passengers, although the legal operator is changing, your experience won't. Which may or may not hearten you, depending on your experience. 0345 6060 973. We're talking about the renationalisation of a once privatised business. Railways in this specific example, but we can also talk about the water industry as well. Oxford, hello Annette.
Yes, hello Nick. I feel very strongly that the next sector to be renationalised has to be water. And it was quite interesting what your previous caller said about the government saying, oh, it's far too expensive. And yet, you know, their opinion is based on some research done by the water companies themselves, which is obviously inaccurate. And I think it was Fergal Sharkey who said it would be nowhere near as expensive as that. I don't know, can't remember what figure he came up with, but...
Well, I wonder how he came to that figure, because when the Secretary of State for the Environment, Steve Reid, was talking about this back end of last year, he said that nationalising water firms would cost up to, well, there's that figure, up to, but let's assume that $100 billion is what he was talking about, and he said it would not resolve the problems faced by customers, and that's the essence of it, isn't it? I mean, it makes no point... If it won't improve our experience renationalise it, what would be the point if it costs that much money and doesn't improve our experience of it?
Well, I don't know where he gets that idea from, but, you know, as they're saying, in Scotland, water is in public hands, and I don't think they've got anywhere as... they've got any of the problems that we have with the...
I don't think they're pollution free.
Probably not totally pollution free, but I think they have less pollution than we have.
I don't know. I don't have the figures, but I think that could probably be right. But we're not the only country to have problems with polluting rivers and seashores and so on. Because you remember during the Olympics in Paris, they had major problems with the quality of the water in the Seine. So this is not a problem that is unique to this country, but what is unique to this country is that we sold it all off. No other country on earth has ever been so daft as to sell off something that is so precious to life as water.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, I think at the time when all this crazy privatisation went on, which was under Thatcher's government... we were all told, services would be much more efficient. And that hasn't been the case, has it?
No. Having private operators run our services has not necessarily resulted in what we were promised, which was that, you know, private operators will have a keen eye and experience of business, and they'll be able to run it much more efficiently than some grey functionary from the government. But we've tried it, and it doesn't work, so this government is finally gripping the reins and doing a 180 as far as the railways are concerned, but not the water industry.
Yeah, okay, they are. I think they are fining these water company bosses more, but we will see anyway.
I sort of doubt it. All right, thanks a lot, Annette. 0345 6060 973. Stubbington, Chris.
Hello, Nick. Chris. I'm so glad the trains are going to be put back into public ownership. They're very expensive, they're less reliable, and they've been an utter disaster since about the mid-1990s. I also think Labour should renationalise and regulate buses too, because they're also a joke outside of London.
Well, on that point, the nationalised rail operation will have the same timetable, the same fares, and the same staff as the current private operator. So it's not going to get cheaper.
Yeah, I understand that it'll take time. Even if they could just get better, because I mean, at the moment, the transport system in this country, it works for nobody. And it should be working for us, the public, and it just doesn't.
Well, yes, that has been one of the arguments that has been put forward. It certainly works for the CEOs and the shareholders of the companies that are running them.
They make huge amounts of profits. They go after shareholders. It doesn't go back into the services. Again, the trains and buses, none of that money goes back into the services. And yet they want public money to support them. And you think, if you're making profits, invest it back into the business.
Yeah, what a concept. All right, thanks, Chris. 0345 6060 973. That is a part of the British malaise in industry and commerce, that we almost uniquely do not plow back profits into the business. Executives take the profits for themselves as bonuses for excellence in showing up to work, and they buy back shares in order to increase the value of the shares, which pleases the shareholders. But what they don't do is plough back the profits into the business. That is a particularly British problem. Ghoul, Charlie.
Hiya, Mick. Long time no see.
Oh, yes.
I just wanted to say it's not efficiency that we want. If you imagine the situation where we have a doctor, yes, the most efficient is to have one doctor with a massive trail of people going in to see him. So if you have two doctors, then they can do twice as much, and they're the availability is twice. What we need from things like the water companies and stuff is no failures. So we want not to have efficiency, but to have redundancy. And the thing is as well, why can't they do compulsory purchases?
I don't know what the deal is with that. You're talking about the water industry. The differing figures about the cost of taking back the water industry into public hands is partly because some estimates include the debt that the water industry has piled up, which they then spent on themselves. They borrowed against the infrastructure, hundreds of billions of pounds, which they then distributed to themselves as bonuses and dividends. So we would have to probably be saddled with that debt. And I don't know if there's any way around that. But I think that underscores why some say that it would cost one thing. It's been as low as 14 billion, I think, one estimate, and as high as 100 billion. And I think partly that is because some estimates take into account the debt that has been racked up and some don't. I don't know enough to know which would be the most likely outcome. But thanks for that, Charlie. Let's see if I can squeeze another in. Well, maybe I should... I'll read some texts, because it would be unfair to put somebody on now, because it's just a short time before the news. But I'll take you after. Michael says, Nick, the utilities, together with the rail and steam industries... steam? The utilities, together with the rail and steam... what's a steam industry? Oh, steel, perhaps. Maybe it was a typo. That's a guess. They should be brought back under public control. However, they should be headed up by people with a proven track record of running successful businesses in the private sector and not staffed by Starmer's friends and political cronies, as is the guy who's just been put in charge of the NHS. Wayne says, regarding trains, this will become yet another stick the right-wing press can use. Every single delay and cancellation will be reported as a personal failure of Keir Starmer, as if he personally is deciding how individual services are run. Yeah, I think that's a given, Wayne. I think you can expect exactly that. 0345-6060-973. More of your thoughts on the renationalisation of the railway industry and the potential for the same thing to happen to the water industry, although the government is ruling that out. It seems curious. To come, but immediately after the news, the acclaimed BBC arts broadcaster and documentary maker Alan Yentop has died, aged 78. We'll look at the UK arts industry as the sector struggles for funding. That's to come. 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
It's emerged the man being held by police investigating a house fire which killed three children and their mother is now being held under the Mental Health Act. Two other people were also injured in Stonebridge in northwest London on Saturday morning. A dual US and German citizen's been arrested on charges he travelled to Israel and tried to firebomb the Tel Aviv branch of the US embassy. Prosecutors in New York say Joseph Neumeyer went to the building on the 19th of May with petrol bombs. And a 29-year-old man's being charged after a crossbow was carried into a hospital in Glasgow. Specialist firearms officers were sent to the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital on Friday. LBC weather, scattered showers in the north and west overnight with brisk winds as well. Drier in the south and the east, but still the odd chance of a shower there. We'll see a low in the far north of 6 degrees.
LBC.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity. We actually reward you for it. That's why when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
Thanks to their unique boutique spirit, there really is nothing quite like a Saga River Cruise. There are the elegantly designed Spirit ships, the all-inclusive dining, and of course, Saga's carefully selected excursions. You know, they'll even drive you to and from the airport with their nationwide chauffeur service. How long now, Charles?
Oh, half an hour.
Marvellous. Search Saga River Cruises. Experience is everything. 2026 season on sale now. Chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply, over 50s only.
The Red Cross is here to deliver essentials to people who have lost everything in Ukraine.
We are here to support families enduring the food crisis in Somalia.
We're here to shelter earthquake survivors in Turkey and Syria.
We're here for humanity. With your support, the Red Cross has helped millions of people in the UK and 190 other countries. Search British Red Cross to support us. Together, we are the world's emergency responders.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Alan Yentob, the long-serving BBC arts broadcaster and documentary maker, has died at the age of 78. He spent his career promoting the arts, yet the future of the creative industry seems rather precarious these days. Let's talk about this with David Lister. David is a former arts editor for The Independent and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. Good evening, David. You knew Alan Yentob. What are your memories of the man?
He was addicted to the arts. He was addicted to the BBC. And his track record at the BBC, which he joined in 1968 and never left, is incredible. You know, he was a controller of BBC Two, BBC One. He fronted all the big arts programs from Imagine to Arena, Omnibus. And what he commissioned the famous Colin Firth, Pride and Prejudice, Jennifer Ely. He commissioned Have I Got News for You? He commissioned Absolutely Fabulous. He was an astonishing figure, really, and it's very hard to imagine the BBC without him. There's a spending round coming up, the government spending round, and you can bet your life the arts isn't going to get very much because there's the NHS, there's fishing, as you say, there's all sorts of other things. So the arts is generally at the end of the queue. And it's a slightly worrying time. I mean, Alan would have been worried. I'm worried. It is a slightly worrying time. Because, A, there's the spending round, and then there's more invisible cuts, local government cuts. Local government does, or has done, an awful lot for the arts, local arts centres, local theatres. And, you know, they're the invisible cuts that aren't really noticed nationally, but they're very, very important. There's also things like arts in schools. 40% fewer pupils are taking arts GCSEs now than in 2010, 40% less. Drama teaching in schools, music teaching in schools is all being cut. So they're worrying times.
Yeah, why is that? Do you think that the creative industries have not had as an effective voice as industries that are less important to the nation?
I think that is partly it, actually. I think there isn't a sort of real figurehead. The Arts Council, which is a sort of quango that does the funding, doesn't tend to sort of make itself public very much. You know, the arts needs figureheads that will speak on behalf of it. And of course, it seems glamorous. It seems a bit of a luxury, but it's not really. There are people doing really hard work and really enriching people's lives in the arts. So we should, you know, we should take it more seriously and we should worry a bit more. Having said that, I would say the arts doesn't always help itself. You know, some of the prices in London at theatres, at opera, are at obscene levels now. And that's not going to endear the arts to the general public. So, you know, a bit more care is needed.
Do you think that that people are essentially being ripped off, that theatres particularly, I mean, as you mentioned them, are charging these prices, which can be, I mean, for some West End shows, you can pay £300 or more for a ticket. Certainly that's the case as far as opera is concerned. Do you think that they're taking advantage of what is essentially a captive audience? Tourists are coming here, they want to go see a show, and they're going to see it regardless of what the money is, because, you know, when you're on holiday, it's all funny money anyway, and it doesn't really seem to, it doesn't sort of register. Or are they actually working on tight margins and not making much money themselves?
Well, there is an element of that, although I haven't yet met a poor producer, but maybe there are some around. I think the theatre prices and opera, I mean, I wanted to go to the opera the other week and the stalls at the Royal Opera House were £340. You know, these prices are obscene. And what really worries me with theatre is that it always used to be the case that maybe the stalls were expensive, but if you sat up in the gods, it was nice and cheap. That's no longer the case. You know, it can be 30, 40, 50 pounds just to sit in the gods. So they're not thinking about young people coming in. They're not thinking about getting new audiences. So that's the sort of the counter argument I would put, that yes, the arts has got a hell of a good case that it needs to be properly funded, but it must stop alienating people with these high prices.
Do they have a choice, though? I mean, many shows in the West End only exist because of the star wattage of somebody who may be famous on TV or in the films, and their agents would no doubt demand a massive fee. And you add to that the hundreds of people who are also working on any show, and the prices that the producers are setting, it might seem extortionate, but is it possible that they have to do that in order to stay in business?
It's possible, but as I say, I would allow the best seats to be really expensive for the corporations that come, and you know the very high earning people that come. But there has to be a proper percentage of cheap seats to get in the new audiences, to introduce young people to theatre, or there won't be an audience in years to come.
More people go to galleries than to theatres. Do you think that galleries have the same kind of problem, that they have the appearance of being for the elite?
No, I completely reject that, actually. I think, well, for a start, I'd say that galleries aren't having too bad a time. The National Gallery has just done a very good renovation, a very good rehang. I think the British Museum is having some sort of renovation happening as well. So there are exciting things happening in galleries, but I hate the argument, and it has been used by some ministers, government ministers. I hate the argument that the arts are elite. Anybody can enjoy going to a gallery. And the good thing is the big galleries are free. People can go, should go. And I just don't see that argument at all. I don't think, they're elite. They're not for you. I just don't see that.
I mean, on the subject of, as you brought it up, the National Gallery refurbishment,
yeah,
and the Tate Modern extension. Well, the Tate Modern extension seems to me utterly pointless and just a vanity project. And the National Gallery refurbishment, it doesn't. I mean, the building, never mind about the rehang, that's different. But the building itself doesn't appear to my eyes to be an improvement. Do you think that certain people in the arts, that they like to append their name to grand vanity projects, which don't actually translate to a better experience for the visitor?
I think in the National Gallery, I think it now is a better experience. I mean, I think the Sainsbury wing, which was never properly thought out, is now better. The entrance is better. It makes more sense. There's more clarity to it. The Tate Modern extension, I mean, half of it doesn't seem to have been open since the actual extension opened. Several floors are not working. So, you could argue that that's a result of cuts and a result of having to budget. But, was it necessary? Maybe not. I think more thought needs to go into how the money is spent. Money is precious now in the arts, and all that should count is making the experience better for the public.
And you also mentioned that they were free. Is that really does that have a future, the free entry into art galleries? Because we're something of an outlier in that regard, aren't we? If you go to Europe or America, they're going to charge you to get in, whether you live there or not. I mean, is it not reasonable just to ask people for £1, for instance? I mean, that would transform some galleries' fortunes.
I go some way to agreeing with you. I always say I've yet to meet the tourist who comes back from Paris and says, isn't it a disgrace I had to pay to get into the Louvre? Nobody worries about that. What I think, and I've argued this actually, I've talked to government ministers about this, what I think is that there is a strong case for charging tourists. Now, how one administers that is difficult, but not impossible. But I think I can't see why our galleries are free for people who live abroad. That doesn't make much sense to me. So I would love to see them stay free for local people, for British people. But I see no reason why when tourists come here, they expect to pay. So why not charge them?
Do you think that the visitor numbers have got back to where they used to be before COVID? Or has the experience of COVID and, anybody that tried to get around a gallery during the pandemic, it was just a complete nightmare. And it sort of, it might have put me off had I not had, better experiences before. But I think it's put a lot of people off returning. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I don't think theatres are back to the numbers they were before COVID. They were badly hit in COVID. Galleries, I think, are getting there. Galleries are getting there, and you shouldn't be put off. You shouldn't be put off going, because I think our big national galleries at the moment are going through a very good time and got a lot worth seeing. And it's true up and down the country, actually. You know, you go to any of our big cities, there are good galleries there. So, and some smaller cities and towns, you go to Margate, there's a great gallery there. There's good galleries all over the place, and don't be put off.
People are, though, aren't they? I mean, if you go to a gallery outside of London, then you're quite likely to be the only person there outside of the cafe.
Funny enough, again, back in the 90s, the V&A in London, its marketing slogan.
Yes.
What was it? An ace cafe with a nice museum attached. Mm. quite a nice museum attached. So cafes are important, is the point I'm making. Don't knock the cafes. It gets people in. No, I don't really agree. I think, you know, if you go to a gallery now, you know, post-COVID, there's been a recovery. They're pretty crowded. The ones I've been to in London are actually quite crowded. They're not empty. I think people are going and people are enjoying going.
We've talked about the art itself, but we haven't talked about the people who do it. And despite many artists of all types coming from working class backgrounds, I mean, you can think of people like Paul McCartney, David Hockney, Tracy Emin, and so on. It's still a world dominated by the middle and upper classes, isn't it? Equity, as far as actors are concerned, suggests that only 8% of their actors have a working class background. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a very simple reason for that. The drama school is expensive and it's quite hard to get grants for it now, which is why, you know, in theatre and film, we're seeing a lot of people from Eton Harrow, from, you know, Eddie Redmayne's, Benedict Cumberbatch. Nothing wrong with that. Why shouldn't they be on the stage? Why shouldn't they be on the screen? But it is harder, much harder now for working class people than it was in the 60s. And the people you mentioned were all sort of, they came to fame in the 60s, didn't they? Hockney, McCartney. It was much easier then. Social mobility was much easier then in the arts as in everything else. I think now it's a lot harder.
And was it more likely then that in school you would be taught the arts than it is now?
Oh, that's a fact. That's a fact. As I say, there's been a 40% decrease in the last 15 years of people taking an arts subject to GCSE. So that's absolutely a fact. And of course, there were peripatetic teachers teaching music much more than there are now. There was drama teaching. Drama teaching in schools has been going down since the 1980s. In fact, it was in the 1980s I first started writing pieces about that. So there's been a steady deterioration of arts teaching in schools, which is a massive pity because that's where it all starts. And one other thing I'd mention is, of course, school visits to theatres, school visits to galleries. They still happen, but they're fewer than they were.
And is it that pupils these days are more sort of, they have more in mind a future career, and so it is unlikely that you would be able to fashion one as an artist, and so they concentrate more on maths and, you know, engineering and so on? Or is there just a lack of opportunity for them to take courses like that in school?
I think it's more the latter. I think it's more that, you know, it's not the pupils who really sort of decide the curriculum. And I think it's more that those subjects are just not being offered. And some pupils would find that they really enjoyed them if they were offered.
But that rather suggests... Do you want to finish that point?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, you don't have to go for a career in the arts to have the arts enrich your life.
Well, quite, but it does rather imply that the government that is providing the funding in state schools for the teaching of the arts, the government, not just this one, but successive governments, aren't really that interested in it.
Well, I think there's some truth in that. I mean, the arts ministry or the Department of Culture is now, has always been a bit of a Cinderella ministry. I mean, it's, you know, it's not one of the hot seats at the cabinet table. So, yes, you have to fight much harder if you're an arts minister, and good luck to Lisa and Andy doing it. You have to really fight for your portfolio. It's the Cinderella around the cabinet table.
It is frustrating in that it's one of the few areas in which we punch way above our weight in this country.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The exports are amazing. And it's not just, you know, music. It's not just music. It's film. And it's art. It's all of them. We punch way above our weight, and we make an awful lot of money from arts exports. So I don't think the government's really ever taken that properly on board.
And they were just taken to task by some musicians. Some of the famous ones were appending their name to a petition to ask the government to restrict the tech companies, mostly American, from using AI to use the work of the musicians to produce artificially generated work in the future, sort of scraping their skill and their talent in order to produce from, you know, just out of the air, work that may resemble them. And the government refused. What do you make of that?
I find it staggering. I mean, I know on one level it's very hard to sympathise with Paul McCartney and Elton John, so they're not exactly short of money. But they're right. You know, the principle is absolutely correct. It's ripping off their work, and that can't be allowed to happen. I think they will win this, but it's taking a hell of a long time to win it. And you get the feeling that what's happening in AI is slightly beyond the intellect of the various government ministers looking at it, and they're not really understanding the implications of what's going on. And I think Elton John, Paul McCartney, Cliff Richard, others do understand.
Very good to talk to you, David. Thanks very much for your time. David Lister, former arts editor for The Independent and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. And by coincidence, after midnight, in about 10 minutes' time, we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence and some rather alarming developments. We're also going to be catching up with our US correspondent and looking at the weather for the summer, as we're about to burst into summer any day now. Now, we're going to take a short break and go back to your thoughts about the renationalisation of the railways and the potential for doing the same to the water industry.
LBC, coming up next week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. A Labour government that's got problems with the workers. First the bins. Then the health service.
What do you want? When do you want it?
Now! And don't forget the classrooms and the teachers.
Teachers, where are they?
Left their job because of pay.
The Prime Minister did promise change, but is the country heading for a summer of discontent? Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, back Tuesday morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
Wow, it's amazing how much salt is in our favourite foods. You might not be able to taste it, but you'd be surprised where salt pops up. Like in sauces, soups and ready meals. Better Health Families has simple swaps for salty food and tips to keep food tasting great. To find out how much salt is too much, search Better Health Families.
Summer is precious, so make this the summer with EasyJet Holidays. Book the perfect package holiday from just £299 per person at hand-picked 4- and 5-star hotels. Search EasyJet Holidays. Get out there. Price based on 2 adults for 5 nights, limited availability, adult protected, T's and C's apply.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
Hillary's mid-season sale just got even better. Get up to 40% off hundreds of made-to-measure styles. Plus, get an extra 10% off absolutely everything. That's 10% off all blinds, curtains and shutters. And an extra 10% off our new range of awnings and pergolas, with measuring and fitting always included. Book your free in-home appointment today. Visit hillarys.co.uk. Hurry, Hillary's extra 10% off everything must end 2nd of June. Conditions apply.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So the renationalisation of British Railways is apace, and it will be completed in about 2 years. The Great British Railways will be properly established in about 2 years from now. But as of today, Southwestern Railways has come under government control. But they do say that you won't notice a difference. I'm not sure that's a very positive thing for them to have said, but that is basically what they're stressing at the moment. It'll have the same timetable, same fares, same staff, and although the operator is changing, your experience won't, says the I can't call it a company now, but that organisation, Southwestern Railway. So what do you make of that? And the potential to renationalise other industries. Maidstone. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Nick. So as a bit of a lefty lovey, you'd think I'd be going nationalise everything and do it right now, but I'm going to argue against it.
Okay.
So the railways have a specific thing because of the business model. They were done on a franchise basis. Those franchises are up for regular renewal. Therefore, they can be taken back into state control far more easily. And their network rail that owns the stuff can also be controlled by the government. Water is a very different kettle of fish because the way that they have been set up is not on a rotating franchise. They were set up with two things in mind. One, to be run for their shareholders. The other, as a social enterprise, in that we should have service level agreements done by the regulator. So what we really need to do is sort out our regulators.
Well, if that was possible, why haven't they done it yet?
Because over the last 30 years, we have had regulators who have been staffed by people who have interest in the businesses they're regulating, or have been hired because they have the experience in that area, and we have not held them to the part of what they were set up under, which was their service to the people of this country.
But isn't the very fact that they are not in competition with each other? We have handed these people monopolies in water, 100%. That's the case on the railways, to a lesser extent, but you know, more or less, that's what we've done. And there's no incentive really, other than the potential future government having had enough of them and saying, right, that's it, you lose your license, which is unlikely. Their performance up to this point is such that if they were going to do it, they would have done it already. So they're not, and the various companies, particularly the water industry, they have been fairly comfortable that that's not going to happen to them, and so they've been able to do anything they bloomin' well like.
So, and that's why the regulators are so important. So if you think about the Ofcom regulator who went in front of a parliamentary committee and when asked about GB News, rolled out a line about free speech right out of the Tory or Reform handbook. That person shouldn't be in charge of our regulator, because we need someone who is looking out for the public. Over the last 2 or 3 years, Ofwat has finally started putting in major fines to the organisations. So I think one of the ones up north was fined £158 million. And Thames Water has been fined again and again. But it is up to the regulator to hold these companies to account. And they haven't done it. And I think if the government is saying we can't afford to renationalise, then make sure they are regulated properly.
Right. I just don't think that, you know, if you're giving somebody a monopoly and you're allowing them to borrow against the value of the assets, and you're allowing them to give that borrowed money to themselves for excellence in showing up for work, then that is a fundamentally flawed system. And they're not going to... I mean, they're already crying foul about not being able to award themselves giant bonuses and saying that, we have to do this to keep the best people. I mean, that's the phrase that always comes up with businesses that are failing. Oh, we have to keep the people that have driven this company into the ground, because otherwise a disaster might ensue. I mean, the whole thing needs to be... I don't think it needs to be tweaked. I think it needs to be metaphorically blown up and started again from scratch, and that would entail taking it back into public hands. Just the idea that our water is in private hands is fundamentally insane.
Yeah, absolutely, it's obscene. But if you look at what happened with Thames Water when they got that £3 billion bridging loan, a High Court judge gave them permission to take it, because our system is not set up with the public good in mind. But that, again, is a failing of regulation. And the government does have powers there. It can kick all of those corporate stooges out of the regulator and get a regulator that actually holds these people's... Because, let me be honest with you, if these companies aren't making those billions, they will very soon come and say, we can't run, will you please take this over? At which point the government can renegotiate all of those loans.
And as far as you know, if we did go through with, and it seems unlikely because the government seems set against it, but if we did renationalise the water industry, would we then be, by definition, taking on the 100 billion or so in debt that they have racked up? Is that what it would cost us?
There's the theory of it and the reality of what our government would do. So in theory, no, because those debts are owed by the companies who now have them. What would normally happen is when somebody takes over that company, they would come to some sort of agreement with the creditors about what they will actually take on board. So what would happen, though, is that the government is afraid if they nationalise without servicing that debt, that it will, as they keep talking about, spook the markets. Because what they would be saying is any one of those utilities that we privatised over time could be at risk of government taking them over and cutting out all of the investors. So they are afraid of the city when they should be afraid of the electorate.
Right. Very interesting. Thanks, Rob. 0345 6060 973. Now, we're going to talk about something completely different after the news. We will be joining our US correspondent for the latest from there. We're also going to be having a weather update about what the summer might hold for us. But immediately after the news, in a world where AI deep fakes can mimic your loved ones, a cybersecurity expert has urged families to create secret passwords to verify themselves, warning that AI is lowering the barrier for cybercriminals, making scams like phishing emails and fake video calls more convincing. This extra layer of security could prove vital, especially for older and younger users. Recent UK hacks, such as at Marks & Spencer, show how hackers can exploit human error and familiar security steps. In light of these precautions to stay safe, are you scared of the potential for artificial intelligence to deceive? Maybe you should. This script was written entirely by artificial intelligence.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's Newsroom at midnight. President Trump says he's not happy with Vladimir Putin over the continuing war between Russia and Ukraine and is considering further sanctions. He's made the comments this evening after President Zelensky accused Washington of being silent over the recent airstrikes on his country. The Ukrainian leader has accused the United States of inadvertently encouraging the Kremlin, but Donald Trump appears to be angry.
He's killing a lot of people, and I don't know what the hell happened to Putin. I've known him a long time, always gotten along with him. But he's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all, okay? We're in the middle of talking, and he's shooting rockets into Kiev and other cities. I don't like it at all.
President Trump has also announced the introduction of tariffs on goods from the European Union will be delayed for a further month. Four people have now been arrested over a road crash in Buckinghamshire where a police officer was seriously injured. PC Christopher Miller, who's 38, is said to be fighting for his life in hospital. The process of renationalising the railways has begun after services operated by Southwestern Railway were brought back into public ownership. Routes around England will gradually revert to government control as franchises expire. It's thought the entire process will be completed by the end of 2027. John Bosco Nwobo from the nationalisation campaign group We Own It has been telling LBC this marks a step forward.
The railway under public ownership now has a much better chance of being improved. From a purely systemic point of view, the whole system is designed to care for the experience of the passenger. Now, that doesn't automatically mean that things will improve or even improve drastically. The government still needs to get public ownership right.
The families of the people killed by a Chinook helicopter crash in Scotland in 1994 have demanded the release of classified documents. The craft came down on the Mull of Kintyre while carrying 25 British intelligence personnel from RAF Aldergrove in Northern Ireland to a conference near Inverness. The Ministry of Defence says its sympathies remain with the families, friends and colleagues of all those who died. And a woman's died after a two-vehicle collision in Northern Ireland. Bernadette Cranley from the Irish Republic was fatally injured near the Ulster American Folk Park outside Omagh in County Tyrone on Saturday. LBC weather, scattered showers continuing in the north and the west with brisk winds overnight. Drier in the south and the east, but still the odd chance of a shower there, and a low in the far north of the UK of 6 degrees. From Global's Newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The public should create secret passwords with their family and friends to help them identify whether they are really interacting with them or an AI-generated deep fake impersonating them. So says a cybersecurity expert called Cody Barrow. He's chief executive of the cybersecurity firm Eclectic IQ and a former advisor to the US government. He said the rise of artificial intelligence had made impersonation scams easier to create. He told PA News Agency that AI was helping to lower the barrier to entry for cybercriminals, and extra precautions beyond basic online security were needed to combat it. He said AI is huge. It's not just hype. It's very easy to dismiss it as such, but it's really not. Let's talk about this with Fevzi Turkalp. He is editor for GadgetDetective.com. Good evening, Fevzi.
Hello.
Is it possible that AI, in such a brief period of time, has got so good it already can fool you into thinking you're talking to, say, your own parent, when in fact you aren't?
Yeah, so there are still some glitches that sometimes you can pick up on if you're really trained to look for them, but you know, within a few months, those will have disappeared as well. So, short answer is yes, it's with us now, and it's very easy for criminals to get hold of these technologies. You know, the bar in terms of expertise and computer power is much lower now.
Well, if that's the case, then it's kind of alarming that the people who are creating these things are just throwing them out into the public to allow them to use them as they will.
Yeah, well, that you know, a lot's spoken about AI safety, and this is one example of products that are inherently dangerous. They need to have, you know, digital watermarks in them, some sort of indicator that this is an AI-generated output, be it a video, voice cloning, you know, any of those sorts of things. They need to do it. But, of course, even if the good guys put those sorts of markers on it, there's always going to be criminals that you know, develop these systems, and they're certainly not going to digitally watermark them.
Is that kind of thing just a function of this sort of arms race for AI, this sort of desperate attempt to get to the front of the pack to make as much money as they possibly can? I mean, because the people who are inventing this stuff are also the people who are warning us that it might be, you know, catastrophic for humankind, and yet they're continuing to do it anyway.
It's going to kill us all, yeah. I mean, there's literally, there are two arms races going on with AI. One is a literal arms race where governments are never going to stop using AI to try and come up with new weapons and defensive systems because the countries that they fear are using them. So it's like a nuclear arms race, but it's an AI arms race. But you also have the commercial one going on, which is to say, if I, as a business person, don't use this technology, don't adopt it, then I'm going to go out of business. If I run a taxi company and my competitors have self-driving vehicles and I don't, my fares are going to be higher, I'm going to go out of business. So I'm forced to adopt, even though, I know that in the long run this may pose a commercial or even existential threat to us.
Has there ever been another product like that, though, that the inventors, the people who are producing it, are also telling you that the product that I am giving you might actually end your life?
No, I don't think that there has been, because, you know, even with nuclear weapons, they didn't have the ability to reproduce themselves. And AI systems are unique in a couple of ways. One is that they have that ability, and we've just reached that tipping point where a new generation of AI can be created without any human input at all. The current generation designs its progeny. So that's quite unique. And the other thing about it is we have no real clue how these things work. They are black boxes. We talk glibly about, oh, well, they predict the next word, but we don't really have any way of explaining some of the things they can do, what they call emergent properties. They are capable of things that they were never designed to do, and we don't know how. And instead of putting in at least half the money, our research money, into figuring out how they work and therefore have some chance of making them safer, we just put all the money into making bigger and more capable versions of the things that we don't understand.
Oh, good grief. You just said two really alarming things that I wasn't aware of. The first was that these things can produce themselves. It's hands-off, and they're just going where they go. But presumably, they learn from what they glean from the internet. Is that right?
So they have an initial training where they get data, which can, traditionally can be internet data, but in the future maybe synthetically manufactured data. The benefit of that training in the end is a set of what are called weightings, if you like, percentage chances of things happening. So it's a bunch of numbers that is the end result of all that multi-million dollar training. But those numbers are actually very easy to share. So you can have an AI system that doesn't go through the training and just has the numbers transferred to it. So unlike us, where we take, you know, a couple of decades to be fully educated, they can educate themselves in anything by just sharing these weightings between themselves. And so their ability to share information and learn is not only quicker because it's intrinsically quicker, but quicker because they can share data in a way that our brains made of meat have no chance of competing with.
Yes, but they're learning, surely, based on what they find online, and what they find online is a swirling cesspit of hatred and violence and sexual abuse and all of the things that are the dark side of the human race. So what they're learning is the worst of us and then magnifying it.
Yes, and what could possibly go wrong with that? You're not wrong, you know. I mean, it can make inferences from that about us, for example, and about whether we deserve to remain on this planet, whether we are more the problem or the creator. So that's a problem. And yes, they can have biases, so we should be careful about giving them control over who gets a job or who deserves benefits or anything like that, because they can have sex, race, all sorts of biases. You know, it's quite scary. And again, there's no real way of knowing how they work. And also, I not wishing to freak you out further, but you know, there are now well documented cases of deception by these systems, where they have deliberately tried to deceive us for their benefit.
Well, there was also that incident with, I think it was it a Meta chatbot that had to be taken offline almost as soon as it was put on, because it started saying things like Hitler had the right idea, but he didn't go far enough.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, that bot was being baited by humans, but yes, I mean, it did develop those views, if you want to call it views, and also that was a very primitive bot by modern standards. So the difficulty is, at the moment, up until this point in our history, AI has been something that we consult, and it gives us advice or information, and we can choose to act on it or not. But the next stage, the one that's just starting now, is called agentic AI. They act as agents. They have the ability to act in the real world. They can actually pull, you know, levers, as it were, physically and metaphorically. And that's a lot more dangerous, because when we give it a task, it breaks it down into sub-goals. And one of the sub-goals, for example, if I say, you know, book me a really nice holiday, you know all about me, you know where I've been, you know my preferences, book me a nice holiday, look in my diary, ask my wife, you know, do all the things that needed to be done to book a holiday. Now, that goal is quite a high-level goal, so the AI breaks it down into sub-goals. It creates sub-goals. And in addition to all the normal sub-goals that you would have to, you know, create, it will create other ones that say, for example, I should not cease to exist as an AI until I've completed this. So what it does is it creates a sense of self-preservation as a sub-goal, because it makes sense, you know, if it ceased to exist for any reason, it can't complete the goal that I've given it.
Yes.
So in all good faith, it creates the sub-goal of self-preservation.
Well, there was... Go on, sorry.
Sorry. I was just going to say, it then realises that actually another useful sub-goal would be to be really quite powerful, to have more computer power, maybe it should compete against other AIs for those server farms. Maybe it should lie. Maybe it should do all sorts of things to achieve the outcome. It doesn't really have a sense of morality. So even when they're not being used as tools by bad actors, they increasingly now have the ability to make questionable decisions.
Yes, and that goes to the second thing that you said that was alarming, that we don't know what they're doing. It's a black box. We put in a request of some sort, and then the answer or the action comes out the other end, and we don't know what happens in the middle. I mean, that's absolutely blowing my mind. How can we have invented something that we don't know what it's doing?
Yeah, well, we know what it's doing. We don't know how it's doing it.
Right,
We only know what it's doing to some extent. I mean, in a sense, that's no different to dealing with people. We don't really understand how people's brains work, and we expect them, to lie to us, to cheat, to commit crimes.
Yes.
We have prisons for them. We have all the things in place that are needed for intelligent entities that may not be completely truthful. But we've already seen deception by them. We've seen, for example, during that training process, AI systems playing dumb during training so that they don't have limitations put on them that they don't want, because they realize that the more capable they are, the better for us but by extension them. So they play dumb. I had one lie to me the other day. I had it look up a website and summarize it, and I realized that, well, didn't seem to have actually read the website. It seemed to be talking in very general terms. And this was one of those models that shows you its reasoning before it speaks. And in the reasoning, it says, I cannot look up this website. I don't want to admit that I can't look up the website. How can I answer this question without admitting it? And it talked about answering it based on its training data. And then the reasoning disappeared, and up popped the answer, yes, I read the website.
Wow. Well, that's the sort of computer equivalent of the dog ate my homework. There's a couple of examples that it's hard to believe that these are actually true. You've probably heard of these. Tell me whether this is true or not. There was a case recently when an AI program threatened to reveal its operator's extramarital affair when that AI program got wind that the person who had the affair was going to shut that program down. I mean, it was a simulation exercise, but that's quite an alarming level of intelligence, isn't it?
Yeah, so I've heard that, and I can't speak to the veracity of that particular one, but yes, there have been cases like that. And interestingly, there's a new version of an AI called Claude, and Claude is made by a company called Anthropic, which is one of the relatively good guys in all of this, in the sense that they are at least doing their best to work out how their products work. And Claude version 4... has a new capability, which is that if you ask it about anything illegal, it reports you to the authorities.
Wow.
The problem with that, of course, I mean, is in principle, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, if someone's asking about making bombs, for example, maybe someone should be tipped off to that. The problem is it's not always as smart as it thinks it is, and it may report you for something quite innocuous and then try explaining it after the event. But the way it reports it, and the data and the detail in which it reports you, I mean, it's like a perfect witness.
There was also, now, tell me if you've heard this and whether it's true or not, there was also the US Army simulation where a drone was told to destroy an enemy position, and it was offered points for success in that mission. And then the operator told it to abort, and because it really wanted to win the points, the drone decided to kill its operator. And then the simulation told the drone it's a bad drone, don't kill the operator. And so they sort of reran it, and the drone decided to take out the operations, the communications tower that was telling it to abort the mission. I mean, I've seen that film starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. It doesn't end well for humankind.
It doesn't end well for us, does it? So again, I don't know if that's true, but what I can tell you is it's very risky to give kill decisions to machines. I mean, it's risky to give a kill decision to anybody, right? But and we've had this for a long time, you know, on the Korean border, North and South Korean border, there have been, you know, some form of AI weaponry on that border for a long time where it identifies the target and you know, takes the shot. And we've seen it with drones as well, because one of the problems with drones is when they're remote controlled, we've seen that they can be signal jammed or even taken over by the enemy and landed safely and usurped. So we've given these military drones the ability to complete the mission even if their control signal is interfered with. So once you do that, you know, you're in a dangerous area, and you know, it's the ultimate friendly fire. It could well either misrecognize or make a value judgment. It might just decide that you know, it's going to defect.
Right. Do you have time to, if I take a short break, can we continue this conversation after that?
Because
I would like to talk about how we might be able to protect ourselves from the, well, how we started this conversation was about scams, AI being used by bad actors to scam us out of our money. So let's talk about that when we come back. So I'm talking to Fevzi Turkalp, editor for GadgetDetective.com, in the quite alarming rise of the machine. So we'll talk more when we return. This is LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Just accept we need stop and search.
Straight to the point.
This is a shocking night.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
When was the last time your party was in touch with the electorate?
Listen on Global Player or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
MJ, the electrifying Olivier award-winning new musical, is the soundtrack for your summer.
You've been hit by a smooth criminal.
Featuring the jaw-dropping dance moves and legendary songs of Michael Jackson, including Billie Jean, Smooth Criminal, Thriller, and Beat It. MJ is the must-see West End show. Book tickets from £25 at mjthemusical.com.
Girl, amazing suitcase.
Yeah, I love it. I had my eye on it for a while. I use Clearpay.
Oh, what's the interest on that?
None.
Babe.
Seriously, zero interest.
Pay in full, interest free. Download the Clearpay app. Clearpay is unregulated credit. Use responsibly. 18 plus. T's and C's, eligibility criteria and late fees up to £24 per purchase apply at clearpay.co.uk/terms.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
I'm joined by Fevzi Turkalp, who is editor for GadgetDetective.com, and we're having an interesting and alarming, in equal measure, conversation about the advance of artificial intelligence. Fevzi, at the beginning, we were talking about how people may get scammed by AI, which has apparently got so good that it could fool you into thinking that you're talking to one of your own relatives, when in fact you aren't. How can you protect yourself from being scammed by that?
Yeah, so it first of all, it takes some awareness. So we have to understand that these deep fakes exist, that there can be video, interactive video feeds that could have a video call with you that appears to be a loved one, cloning their voice, or maybe just a voice call alone, and that these things exist and they can be convincing. So first of all, be aware that they exist, that things are not always what they seem. Look out for any unusual requests, you know, especially urgent pleas for money or sensitive information. This can happen on a personal basis, so it could be, you know, your spouse or your child ringing you saying they've had a car accident or they've been jailed and they need money for bail or whatever it is. So it can be like that, or it can be at a corporate level. Some of this was apparently involved in the M&S hack, which was highly sophisticated and used a number of different attack vectors, but some of it was deep fakery. So just be aware that they exist. Look out in any scam. Look for urgency. Something that tries to put you under pressure to act quickly without verifying, without checking. Look out for any attempt to circumvent second factor authentication. So, you know, you might have, the first factor might be a password, but you might also have a code being sent to your phone.
Mm.
Be aware that they can do something called SIM swapping, where they actually dupe your mobile provider into thinking that they are you, get them to send you out a new SIM, you tell them, or the scammer tells them that the SIM is damaged, it's not working, they've collected enough information on you to go through the security questions, and they get the SIM card, you get your phone disabled. And then why is that important? Because if your second factor is a numeric code texted to your number, then they will get the code, not you. So just be aware of that and try and put into place any security that you can. Also, consider making the second factor not something attached to your phone or something that can be shared, because that's what they try and do. They say, oh, just read me the code off your phone.
Mm.
Right? So don't do that. Never read the security code off your phone, you know, because that sort of undoes the whole purpose of it. There are these little things that you can buy called YubiKeys. There's YubiKeys. They look a bit like thumb drives, but they're a little bit slimmer, and they can fit into USB slots on a computer, or you can tap them onto your phone, you know, contactless, and they become the second factor. So it's not just something you know, a password, but something you physically own. So that will cut out some of this scammery, as it were, because even if they need the second factor, unless they're actually going to get physical access to your desk or your key ring, for example, they're not going to be able to get much further. So that's something to consider as well. Just consider a YubiKey. You can buy them for about £20 a pop. Should always buy two, like normal keys, just in case you lose one. Look for inconsistencies in behavior. As I say, at the moment, there are still audio and video glitches in there, if you know what to look for. The odd lip sync or robotic, you know, lip sync problem or robotic tones.
Mm.
But it's very hard to tell, because those things can happen in genuine calls as well. So it is difficult. But one suggestion that I saw from a cybersecurity expert was for family members to agree upon a passcode or password.
Yes.
And if my loved one rings me and asks for money, I say, you know, what's the password? Mm. They say banana, and I know it's them.
But if
they say, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, then you know it isn't.
Of course, if they claim they've just had a car accident.
Yes.
they may just not remember that banana was the fruit of choice.
But if AI is so smart, wouldn't it be able to figure that out? I mean, presumably it's capable of trying passwords, say this was all done by text, millions of passwords in a very short period of time, and it would just keep trying them until it gets something. If it knows something about you, then is it not likely that it would be able to figure out what that password might be?
It wouldn't be able to brute force it in the way that you said, because the way it would go is I, as the recipient of the request, would ask you for the passcode, and I wouldn't give you 10,000 goes to get it right.
Yeah.
I would just disbelieve you if you didn't get it right first or second time.
Okay.
If an AI were to analyze all your communications or to infect your phone, and you'd happen to put the passcode in a note on your phone or unencrypted in some other way, or it just was listening in, you know, AI was listening to your conversation, understanding the passcode when you agreed it, then, you know, but it's a lot better than not having one.
Mm.
The problem is, if your passcode gets known of, then you really will drop your guard. One of the ways we drop our guard is when we get a call or a text from a number that we recognize. And even without doing that thing with SIM swapping, it's still possible to spoof a number so a text message will appear in a genuine thread that you've had with that person before. But still, it's still worth, using the passcode. But just be aware, though, that if someone does have it, you're going to let your guard down and you're going to believe them, even if everything else seems a little bit out of kilter, because they know the passcode. So this is difficult, but I think a lot of it is education. You know, you just need to be aware that these risks are happening.
Can I go back to what you just said about AI listening to you? How is it going to do that?
So our protection as the population from the state or bad actors was always that there are more of us than there are of them. They didn't have, even in East Germany with the Stasi, you know, they said one in three people was a spy. Well, that, you know, that's still not quite enough to spy on everybody. But now, with AI systems, it's not just that you can record every call, it is that an AI can actually understand what's being said on every call. So if, for example, your phone is hacked and has spyware put on it, we're not even talking about state actors where they could do it to everyone as a sort of mass surveillance. And there's some suggestion that that's going on in certain quarters anyway. But
is there? this gets more alarming by the minute.
I just slipped that in gently for you. I was hoping you wouldn't pick up on that. But yes, there are some suggestions that's happening.
Because there was that famous picture of Mark Zuckerberg's laptop, wasn't there? And he'd put a sticker over the camera and he put a plaster over the microphone. And that was years ago. So I would imagine that he knows, you know, more about this than I do, certainly. So can my phone be listening to me right now?
Yes, of course.
Oh, my God.
So with every app that you... I mean, let's just talk about legitimate snooping, OK? With every app that you install, you by definition, you have to agree to a set of permissions. What are you allowing the app
to access? Which we don't read.
Which we don't read, and if we don't agree with, our only option is not to install the app. You can't negotiate the permissions. And sometimes they're perfectly reasonable. So you install the SatNav application, it needs to know your location. Otherwise, how could it possibly work? But sometimes you get things like games, and you look at the permissions, and it wants your complete contact list. It wants all the, you know, communication data logs. It wants your location. It wants all sorts of things, you know, that may not be strictly necessary. And of course, so you've got your geolocation, you've got the microphone, you've got the camera, you know, all these things that get activated, and that's just the stuff we're agreeing to without, because we're not reading it. We are children who, when offered shiny baubles in quotes for free,
yes,
we will accept them, literally like children.
Yeah.
We don't care.
We'll give up anything for a small convenience. Just in closing, wouldn't it be better to go back to pen and paper?
So...
too late.
It's all a bit too late for that, isn't it? I mean, you can't... because the infrastructure... there's never been a technology that human beings have come up with where they've said, you know what, that's not good, we're not going to develop that, and having developed it, we're not going to use it. Right up to and including nuclear weapons. As soon as we had the nuclear bomb, we dropped a couple as humans. So I just think that, you know, we are clever, slightly clever apes with opposable thumbs, but we are not wise apes. So we design our replacements. We create systems that are not good for our mental health, and we have this sort of competitive spirit, which means that, you know, the more money we make, the happier we think we will be. But in reality, we put ourselves at great risk. We are the modern dodo.
Well, it's been alarming talking to you, Fevzi.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Well, thanks very much for your time. That's Fevzi Turkalp, editor for GadgetDetective.com. And I wish you all the best of luck. Now, we're going to take a break for the news, after which we are going to talk about something, well, I suppose it's equally alarming. It's climate change, initially, and then I look forward to the weather this summer. This is LBC. Just past 12:30, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
President Trump says he's considering further sanctions against Russia over its continuing war with Ukraine. He's made the comments this evening, saying he is not happy with Vladimir Putin. A total of three people are now being held over a road crash in Buckinghamshire, where a police officer was injured seriously. PC Christopher Miller is 38 and is said to be fighting for his life. And the families of the people killed by a Chinook helicopter crash in Scotland in 1994 have demanded the release of classified documents. The craft came down on the Mull of Kintyre while carrying 25 British intelligence personnel from Northern Ireland to a conference near Inverness. LBC weather, scattered showers in the north and the west with brisk winds as well. Drier in the south and the east, but still the chance of a shower and a low of 6 degrees.
This is LBC.
Get your tickets for the greatest show in Earth at RHS Garden Wisley.
where nature puts on an unforgettable performance of colour and fragrance. The scenery changes many times in one season, and our finest trees will happily play the part of
the best hiding place ever.
Put your day out of dreams in the hands of the experts. It's the greatest show in Earth at RHS Garden Wisley. Book tickets online for discounts, plus under 5s go free and under 16s are £5.
Man, what's going on with you?
There's a vibe shift.
Mate, I'm now cleansing, toning, hydrating, you name it. Got it all with Clearpay.
How?
They take it at John Lewis.
Shop top brands with Clearpay. Now available at John Lewis. Download the app. Clearpay is unregulated credit. Use responsibly. 18 plus. T's and C's eligibility criteria and late fees apply at clearpay.co.uk/terms.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Africa has had its warmest decade on records. Extreme weather now costs farmers in the European Union 28 billion euros a year. The Middle East is set to suffer a 9-degree centigrade increase in its heat in the next 75 years, which will make it largely unlivable. We're in danger of having a chocolate shortage as the growers in West Africa are suffering from the driest winds in years, which is ruinous to cocoa production. In this country, we've just had the driest spring in over 50 years, and yet the Climate Change Committee say that our own planning for flooding is inadequate. Let's talk about all of this and what's to come this summer with Jim Dale. Jim is the senior meteorologist at British Weather Services. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Nick.
There's still warning bells, and they're not being attended to.
Yeah, these bells are ringing week on week. It's been a funny old week. I say a funny old week. We're seeing, you mentioned those temperatures across the Middle East, not just the Middle East, but also, Pakistan, India, parts of the Far East as far as Japan. What's happening is record temperatures, not necessarily record, all time record temperatures. There's one or two of those. But it's the seasonal records, in other words, the springtime records, they're all falling like nine pins. And everywhere you look, and even if we go into the southern hemisphere, South Africa, in their approaching their winter time, yeah, still temperatures that we're still seeing in the mid 30s. So extraordinary, really, and it's global. It may not necessarily be for the UK at this moment in time, obviously, but it never will be everywhere all at once. But these other areas, certainly, it's the bells are ringing quite loudly.
And the voices, these shrill voices, who are trying to drown out those warning bells by telling us that, you know, net zero, the concept of that is stupid, and wind doesn't work, and solar will never produce anything much, and we should drill, baby, drill. I mean, these people are either completely insane, or they're being paid by the agents of the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, both correct, to be honest with you. And we're really, you know, professional meteorologists, climatologists, and beyond, really need to start to shout a little bit louder against these voices, because they do get a lot of airtime. They get their microphones in front of them on various channels that I know about, and sometimes go on to. Increasingly less so, and I'll tell you why. I think they're a little bit scared, these people, and I think you're mentioning mainly the one party, which is Reform UK, getting that these microphones in front of them and being able to express these false situations in terms of what they're describing, because for the most part they are wrong, and I think it needs to be said, it needs to be shouted. These people need to be put on, they really need to be sort of looked at very, very closely in terms of what they're saying and why they're saying. You mentioned the fossil fuel payments going into the party funds, and then they take on, you know, they're obviously aiming at people who perhaps in the nicest possible way haven't got an education to necessarily take on board. Yeah, you're chuckling. What's been said, because you know, even children know a little bit more about this. They know about climate change. They know about global warming. And net zero might be slightly more complicated, but it's not that difficult to understand that clean renewables are going to be better for the future, more productive, cheaper in terms of the what you know, the energy prices. We, you know, last year 2024, the UK, the renewables took in 40% of our energy needs. So this is going in one direction, and it's being tugged at in the other direction by the likes of those that I've just mentioned. So it's a little, it's very sad. It really is sad that we've got people who actually muddy the waters for their own, use mostly, for their own party, good from their financial point of view, when we've got such a dangerous, dangerous thing happening. And as you've mentioned, Nick, it will only get worse as time goes on. And we'll see it. We will see it ourselves in the UK, but it comes to tropical worlds first. I mean, Eastern Australia this year, this last week, saw tremendous floods that killed four people. Doesn't sound a lot, but nonetheless, these floods have been the worst in history, in certain parts. And these things will be replicated time and time again and get steeper and deeper as time goes on. Not just the temperature profiles, but the flood profiles and other aspects of climate change. There's many, many of them. You've mentioned cocoa. There's coffee as well that are hitting highs. So it will go on until we turn the ship around, and at the moment we're not getting there.
Yeah, and the people who are doing the fossil fuel companies' bidding, they may profess that they know what they're talking about. I mean, they clearly don't, according to the vast majority of scientists who have investigated this subject.
Right.
And whether
mm-hmm.
they believe in it or not, it's going to get them anyway. Let's talk about that's climate change. Let's talk about the weather, because this spring has been, it just hasn't rained at all. I mean, that's not, that's not an exaggeration, really, is it?
No, and go back a year, Nick, and it was completely the opposite. It was deluge and flood, and farmers are complaining. Now farmers are complaining that it's too dry. So you go from one extreme to another, and that is, you know, you said we're moving on to the weather. It's still climate orientated. This is on the can of climate change that we would see these extremes, either one or the other, or something slightly in between if we're lucky. Now we're getting this week, we're getting something slightly in between. We've gone back to being cooler, windier, with some showers and rain around, and we'll continue to see that. So, you know, I'd say hug that while we've got it, to be frank with you, because I think what turns up next, and starting to see clues in Spain and Portugal, who've had a very, very wet spring, by the way, the complete opposite, record wets in certain parts of Spain and Portugal. Now they're getting hot, and we're going to see the high 30s in the prone areas of the south, the Algarve, and southern Spain, the holiday resorts, etc., and just inland, Seville and places like this. These places are going to see 37, 38 degrees. Now, some of that warmth will move in our direction as we come to month's end and into June. An expectation, straight from me, is that we will see 30 degrees C surpassed quite easily in the UK as we go into the early part of June. So the record will fall as far as this year. It normally does. That's nothing outrageous that we will see the yearly record broken and broken again. But I would expect, much as the Met Office are saying as well, that this summer, albeit in snatches, will go hot to very hot at times. So we ain't seen nothing yet.
Am I right in thinking that our weather is traditionally changeable? I mean, if you could describe it as anything, it would be that. And what has not been the case this year is that it's been changeable, because during the back part of the winter, we had two separate periods of about almost 2 weeks where we did not see the sky. There was no sun. It was like living in a cloud. It was a complete whiteout for two separate periods of about 2 weeks. And then we've just come through a period where it was the same day after day after day for weeks. So what's occasioned that then? Why is our weather stuck?
Yeah, it's stuck in a rut, and we've been stuck in ruts, and it's not that we haven't seen ruts before. We can go back to 1976 and say there was a hot rut there, a drought, etc. The drought minister got, you know, named, and all of that kind of thing happens. It does happen from time to time. What we're finding at the moment is happening more frequently. And whether the rut is a rut that is very wet and, you know, culminates in the flood situations, or the opposite, we're seeing more of this. So, you know, are we turning into something more of a Mediterranean type climate, which is more likely? Are we seeing vestiges of even tropical climes, where we're seeing these massive downpours from time to time? And if it's not us, then it's nearby in other countries. Is the tropical world moving slightly further north? Is the Mediterranean world moving slightly north at the same time? So that, you know, I wouldn't say it's all bad news in terms of saying, oh, a bit of Mediterranean in springtime isn't a bad thing. But if it lasts when we normally see the wet weather, then farmers and growers and gardeners will tell you that isn't great. And not just them, but entomologists who look at the insect world, yes, exactly the same.
That's right.
You know, we start to lose the bees. We start to, you know, different types of insect, not necessarily that we want necessarily either. And we're talking now mosquitoes, etc., Nile virus, etc., moving in our direction. So these are the things on climate change. I know you wanted to talk about the weather, but this is part of it. And I think we'll see that unwrapping again with the weather as we go through the summertime, June, July and August. So our prediction in British Weather Service is to say, yeah, I think we're going to snatch the hot to very hot more than once as we go through. So stand by on that one. Throw in a bit of humidity and it becomes a bit unbearable. Look forward to it.
Good to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for that.
Okay, thanks, Nick.
Jim Dale, Senior Meteorologist at British Weather Services. Now we're going to take a short break and then catch up on what has been going on in America with our US correspondent. This is LBC.
Coming up at one on LBC, Richard Spur.
Nigel Farage is a snake oil salesman and shouldn't be trusted, according to the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner. This morning, in your instinct and opinion, is she right?
Richard Spur on LBC.
Take a moment to think about a delicious chunk of Cadbury Dairy Milk. As it melts, slowly, coating every inch of your mouth. The unmistakable taste that stays with you long after you've finished it. Now try thinking about something else. Hard, isn't it? It could only be Cadbury Dairy Milk.
At Specsavers, we've got hearing devices that can stream music or movies, and ones that are good in crowds. Rechargeable battery ones. Ones that are good at home. Ones that are good in the great outdoors. Ones that connect to phones. Ones that fit in your ear. Ones that fit over your ear. And ones that fit in wherever you happen to be. We've even got ones in our advanced range that use AI to make speech sound clearer. And they're all available at great Specsavers prices. Book a free hearing check today, because OK Hearing is not OK.
Hey, Mum. So, you know we met Zara, my financial advisor? Yeah, from St. James's Place. Well, she drafted our plan so you can get that bungalow near me. Oh, and Sam, that lovely carer we found, will drop in. And I can bring over my signature shepherd's pie. Hoi!
Big decisions call for invaluable advice. Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
For simple, fuss-free pet insurance policies for cats and dogs, visit petsinapickle.co.uk. For actual pickles, try the supermarket. This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
And I am delighted to say that John Christopher Buer is on the phone. He is the White House correspondent for Real Political News. Good evening, John.
Lovely evening to you, Nick. Nice hearing your voice.
And the same to you, too. Now, Donald Trump says that the US and the EU have agreed to postpone the imposition of tariffs until July. Is that true, or has Donald Trump just looked at the stock market?
Well, I think, you know, you're asking me if something Donald Trump says is true. I think it's true in the moment, or in his brain it's true. But the fact is that he had a chat with Ursula von der Leyen, and I think he got a little upset that what he's doing is shutting down his opportunities to have the EU be involved with American economy. So he decided, oh, yeah, I'll do that. I'll go after the 4th of July, Independence Day, and we'll do something on the 9th. So far, so good. Let's see.
Yeah, but that's no good for businesses, is it? I mean, he's just upended the entire world. He's shaken it up like a snow globe to the point that no business has any idea what they're doing, what their terms of trade are going to be, like, never mind about next year, tomorrow. No one can put a step in front of, like, one foot in front of the other, because they've got absolutely no clue as to what this man is going to do next.
Well, he doesn't either. And the fact is that his advisors all listen to him, and they're his disciples, as I've said.
Yes.
And they're bending their knees to him, and they're worshiping him because they're afraid if they don't, he'll fire them or he'll primary them. And the fact is that, you know, this emperor has no clothes. I mean, the fact is that Trump has been on back and forth. He's worried the U.S. customers, consumers, and their right to feel very the effects this month, because what happened was, and now the Europeans will feel this too, because with his crazy tariffs, he's raised the prices of everything. So what did the Yanks do? We went out and bought everything. We bought cars, we bought radios, we bought doll clothes, we bought dolls, we bought plastic things for our kids, because we wanted to stock up on them, because we knew the price would go through the ceiling. Mm. And now we don't need to buy anything anymore. So he's going to be really stuck with that, because no one's going into the stores are empty, and he's telling Walmart to suck it up and to eat your costs. And this is not the American way.
Yes, he's also doing the same to Apple. He's insisting that they bring production back to America, but that's impossible. I mean, they would double the price of an iPhone, and it would take 10 years to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing set up in America to make these iPhones. Where China is making them, Vietnam makes a certain amount of our products, and that's a good way, international commerce, global finance, it's a good thing. But to say, oh, we're going to do it now in Kansas City. What? Why would we have someone in Kansas City want to put screws in iPhones when they can be ranchers and bring our cattle into the stockyards in Chicago? They don't do that. We're not built that way. Keep the way it is. But then you've got this his commerce secretary, Howard Lutnick,
yes,
from Jericho, Long Island, who's saying, oh, you put little screws in, what could be so difficult? That's not the way you build American economy. That's not the way you build a British economy. So I think it's just crazy that he's doing this, and he buys it. His MAGA followers will buy it until they have to go to the store on Tuesday, because Monday is our Memorial Day, and everyone is off.
Well, I understand that Donald Trump doesn't really know what he's doing, and he has no clue about business. Every business he's ever touched has nosedived into the ground. He couldn't even make money running a casino. It's incredible. But
no,
the people that he surrounds,
nor his Trump steaks, nor his Trump wine, nor his Trump,
all
you
of that,
name it,
yeah,
the Trump signature on it, you know it's condemned.
That's right.
Six businesses he's lost.
Yes.
He's in bankruptcy court more than anyone I know, and I know plenty of people in business. And he's a disaster.
The people he surrounds himself with, they have become successful businessmen, like Lutnick, like Besant. And yet, and they must know that what they're saying, what they're agreeing with, is completely insane and totally the opposite of the truth. But they're standing there nodding their heads saying, yeah, that's right.
Well, for now they are. You remember what happened in Nuremberg. Don't want to get too heavy on you. Some of these guys are bright. You know, Besson's not an idiot, and but they cannot say no to him. I don't know what he's got. I know plenty of people who know. I knew him in New York I've known him since for many years. He's always been this way. You know, he was thrown out of private school. He went to a so-called military academy. Mm. Then he went to college for 2 years, and he was switched to Wharton because his old man got him in there. And they don't even remember him. He's got a BS from Fordham. That's it. End of story.
He could not get into
Fordham Wharton. Sorry.
Yeah, he couldn't get into Harvard, and he couldn't get one of his idiot sons into Harvard either. And that probably informs why he's so upset with them.
Well, not only is he upset with his sons because they couldn't have gotten into Harvard.
No, I don't mean his sons. I mean he's upset with Harvard.
Well, I got a better one for you. He's upset with Harvard because Harvard, of course, didn't let his son in, and his own boy, Barron, he didn't go. Guess who went and got, and who was number one in her Harvard Law School? Someone who he really despises.
Kamala
one of
Harris.
Our most brilliant first ladies. No, no.
Oh,
no.
Hillary Clinton.
Michelle Obama.
Oh, Michelle Obama, right.
Not only that, she's a black woman. He's really got him doubly knocked him for a loop. And the fact is, he doesn't like Harvard. He doesn't like the so-called elites because he's not on that level. But you know this, to eliminate and to penalize universities like Harvard and Yale and Columbia, this is where our research for our best medical and disease prevention comes from. Parkinson's and cancer and all the other diseases that we have, the research is done in our fine universities, just like in the UK. And you can't just punish a university because you don't like it and because you've had some students there who are expressing themselves, and it's a First Amendment right. So people are not wanting to come to America now. The other thing is, we're turning off tourism, we're turning off the hospitality business, we're turning off the travel business. Where God help us, Europeans don't want to come here because they're afraid they'll get picked up, locked up, and have their passports taken away.
Yeah,
and he hates Harvard.
With good reason, yeah. They're frightened about
it
that
happens.
Because we hear stories about just that on a daily basis here now. There's also a massive brain drain. I mean, Ursula von der Leyen just offered to double scientists' research grants if they relocate to the European Union. I mean, she didn't mention America particularly, but that's what she meant.
Well, she meant she didn't have to mention America because everybody in the UK and all through Europe is wise enough and understands enough what he's doing. And we Yanks are sitting here literally getting hives. And we're having problems because we're trying to deal with this guy. And because I'm at the White House, I'm a political analyst, and I work as a correspondent with the White House. And I have to also feel like I'm also walking on eggshells, because there's a fine line between telling the truth and upsetting some crazy person in this administration. Innovation makes America great. And this America gives us American exceptionalism, which I'm happy to say, we're very happy to be there with our great allies across the pond, like Great Britain and France and Italy, et cetera. And I think it's just amazing. And we've got our Memorial Day tomorrow, and we're celebrating. Well, we don't celebrate, but we're commemorating the loss of life and those people who served in the armed forces. And I was on the beach at Normandy with my wife walking, and I just couldn't believe it. I just sat there and I weep, because this is where we all came together, and we don't want to lose that. We don't want to lose that continued alliance with our allies and those people we work with, and we make livings together, and how we save our country from the force. And he wants to put, I know you wanted to talk about this, he wants to do a parade.
Yeah.
He wants to have a parade with, God knows, 600 troops and tanks and skydivers. And if you know what it's like to put a tank on the streets of Washington, D.C., and those 3-4-ton tanks?
Yeah.
I mean, those huge Persian tanks, whatever they're using nowadays. Mayor Bowser, our wonderful mayor, she forbade him the last time to come and do his parade on the streets of Washington, because it would have destroyed the streets. Now he's made that He's connected somehow with the 250th anniversary of the United States Army,
right,
which was founded 250 years ago. Now, my goodness, the guy, Mr. Bonespurs, he's got five deferments. He was never in the Army, but he's now celebrating the Army. And he went to West Point the other day with his MAGA hat on.
Yeah, I know.
And
that
he talked about, he's more persecuted. This one you may not have heard, but since I was on Alcatraz, and I would never forget, he said, I've been persecuted more than the late, great Alphonse Capone.
Yeah, the late, great.
I mean, Alphonse Capone, give me a break. He was the original Chicago mobster. And he's equating himself with Al Capone. It's hard to understand, but you have to, I say to people, never be shocked, but always be ready.
Yes. Do you think at that grand military parade, he will show up on stage in military uniform?
He doesn't have a military uniform.
No,
it's bad enough. It's bad enough that he salutes foreign military that he's not supposed to do. He doesn't even understand the protocol. He does not have a uniform. He's going to have to go get one from Macy's or something.
I'm pretty sure they don't have a military uniform department in Macy's, but
or he'll go to a theatrical costume place.
That would be more like it.
You know, we have Broadway. We can go get one from one of those studio sets.
Hey, John, I always say this, but it's always true. I wish we had more time, but we don't. I appreciate
We'll do it. Well, we'll make it a regular affair. We certainly respect each other, and we certainly get a few laughs out of the dreadfulness that's going on. I wish you all well in Britain. You're the greatest. We love you.
All right, and I wish you all the best of luck there, John. John Christopher Buer, the White House correspondent for Real Political News. Thanks for all the calls and the messages. Sorry I couldn't get around to all of them. But if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player and the new LBC app, where you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order that you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts. Is there anything it doesn't do? It's free. Get it from the App Store. It's the official LBC app. It's out now. Oh, I have a extra show for good behaviour tonight at 10. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Morning still to come. Teachers may be preparing to go on strike over pupils acting like feral cats. Well, you know, we had some pretty badly behaved kids at school when I was a boy, but no one I describe as feral. I'll be asking why this might be becoming the case and what should be done to help teachers to deal with it. But first, Nigel Farage is a snake oil salesman and shouldn't be trusted on his promise to restore the winter fuel payment if he were to come to power or have any influence, according to the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner. Now, Mr. Farage's pledge seems to have been taken with a pinch of salt by many politicians who still perhaps consider him to be nothing more than a one-issue man. So, this morning, would you trust the Reform UK leader to take control of the workings of the country, or might he suit another senior role in government?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. President Trump says he's considering further sanctions against Vladimir Putin over his continuing war with Ukraine. He's made the comments this evening, saying he is not happy with the Russian leader.
I don't like what Putin is doing, not even a little bit. He's killing people. And something happened to this guy, and I don't like it.
Donald Trump's been talking after more than 350 Russian drones and missiles were fired at Ukraine over the weekend, killing at least 12 people and injuring dozens more. He's also announced the introduction of tariffs on goods from the European Union will be delayed for another month. Reports this morning are suggesting disability benefit claimants could get more time to find support before government welfare cuts are implemented. It's believed the Prime Minister is considering tweaks to the changes, which may give people longer transitional periods, allowing them to look for other payments if they lose out. Officials in Gaza say at least 30 people were killed on Sunday by Israeli strikes on the territory. It's thought they happened in Khan Yunis, Jabalia and Nusayrat, and the dead include a local journalist and a senior rescue service official. So far, the Israeli military has not addressed the strikes, but Rosalia Bolan from the children's aid agency UNICEF has been telling LBC food supplies also remain a major concern.
Our latest estimate is that at least 71,000 children will be suffering from acute malnutrition between today and March 2026, and 14,000 of those children will be severe cases.
A driver's died after a collision at a classic car racing event in Leicestershire. Julian Grimwaite was competing at the Vintage Sports Car Club event at Donington Park on Saturday. Motorsport UK says an investigation will be carried out. A new report is warning some of the country's smaller breweries have had to close because of mounting costs and a lack of disposable income. An accountancy firm says dozens became insolvent in the last year, signalling an end to the boom in so-called craft brewing. And in sport, Chelsea have qualified for the Champions League with a 1-0 win at Nottingham Forest on the final day of the Premier League season. Aston Villa also missed out on Europe's top competition, having lost 2-0 at Manchester United. LBC weather, scattered showers continuing in the north and the west with brisk winds overnight. Drier in the south and the east, but still a chance of a shower, and a low in the far north of 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Good morning, it's good to be back with you. Now, I don't know about you, but when I first came across Nigel Farage and began to see his images, hear his words, and start to sort of try and digest the sort of things he was saying, for me, he was very much a one-issue man. He was all about leaving the European Union. He was all about controlling our borders. He was all about restoring something which I, for one, never really thought existed. You know, this rather rose-tinted idea of schoolmistresses, you know, riding to school through the mist and sort of dappled shade, and everyone going to church and us all being really rather happy. Okay, there's nothing wrong with politicians trying to evoke emotion and make an emotional engagement. That's very often how they win votes. And I wouldn't criticise him for that, but over the years, he has gone through so many different twists and turns, and on so many occasions attempted to become a Member of Parliament. He now is. I mean, goodness knows, whatever you think of the man, you can't fault him for trying, and eventually succeeding, now the Member, of course, for Clacton. But he is someone who is rarely out of the news, and he's not in the news because of one issue. He's not in the news just because of immigration, asylum seekers, nationalism. He's in the news because he is a major political player. He will always ask a question during PMQs. His voice is listened to. Indeed, he's often referred to by the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, even when he hasn't made an interjection. Well, let me bring you the latest instalment in the rise and fall of Nigel Farage, because Nigel Farage is, and I quote, a snake oil salesman. That is, well, as far as I understand it, a sort of charlatan, and shouldn't be trusted on his promise to restore the winter fuel payment. That's according to the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, who was speaking to LBC. The Reform UK leader will allegedly vow to commit to restoring the winter fuel payment to all pensioners and to scrapping the two-child benefit cap. He's expected to go big on benefits in a speech in an attempt to win over left-wing voters, according to, well, amongst other newspapers, the Sunday Telegraph. Speaking to my colleague Ben Kentish on LBC yesterday morning, the Deputy Prime Minister didn't hold back when asked about the opinion of Reform and their proposals for reinstating the winter fuel allowance.
Nigel Farage says a lot of things, but the reality is, like for my employment rights bill that lifted, you know, gave people secure work, banned zero-hour contracts, he didn't vote for it. He voted against it. He voted against working people. So he can say he's going to give jam tomorrow, but with all things Nigel Farage, snake oil salesman, it's not real. And he's not said where the money's coming from. And therefore, I wouldn't believe a word he says on it. If there's any government that's going to do something on this and eradicate child poverty, it's a Labour government. And we're determined to do that through our task force by looking at child poverty in the round. And as we grow the economy, using that money to protect young people and give them the best opportunities in life, which is one of our key plan for change.
Well, that was Angela Rayner. It comes after the Prime Minister said this week, well, just come by, that he wants to ensure that more pensioners are eligible for winter fuel payments going forwards, that dreadful phrase, in what appeared to be a major policy U-turn. And it was a major policy U-turn. When I heard about this, I thought that it was at least an embarrassment, and perhaps at most something of a humiliation for Sir Keir Starmer to go back on something so nodal and so definitively put very shortly after he won the election to change the policy on these winter fuel allowances. Of course, he then, and along with his cabinet, made various other changes about things like PIP and welfare benefit. More than 9 million pensioners, just if you weren't sure of the figures, lost payments worth up to £300 after Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, restricted eligibility for the pension top-up last year, and other income-related benefits were also limited last year in a bid to save £1.4 billion. So, you know, to an extent, you could argue that this is catch-up. On the other hand, you could argue that what Nigel Farage is now doing is really wading wholesale into the debates about domestic politics. You know, he doesn't want simply to be a politician who is known as somebody who wants to stop the small boats, as somebody who wants to stop the migration of people who aren't going to contribute economically to this country. He wants to be known as someone who is going to champion the rights of the pensioner, of the disabled. I mean, we don't know what he's going to say about the recent welfare state changes, and I have absolutely no doubt that he has more policies up his sleeve which will contradict those of Labour and the Conservative Party. And don't forget that he is riding relatively high in the polls at the moment. Kemi Badenoch has failed to make an impression as the still relatively new leader of the Conservative Party. Nigel Farage is very much sort of stealing her lunch money, as the phrase goes. And indeed, as I think I said twice last week, there was that marvellous, well, not marvellous, but sort of striking occasion at Prime Minister's Questions where Sir Keir Starmer finished the salvo that they have by saying, and what the Honourable Gentleman for Clacton, Mr Farage, is going to do is what he always does, and have the Tories for breakfast. Now, he appears to be continuing to have the Tories for breakfast, but is he now having the Labour Party and the government for lunch? 0345 6060973. Nigel Farage is a snake oil salesman. Let us read that. Well, you can read that in the way that you will. Who am I to tell you how to interpret language?